It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
We like fighting a woman.
What is with this company's obsession with ninjas?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and threaten me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster, who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
The big news of the week shook the wrestling world to its core. Road Dogg has left Twitter. His page is still up, but I guess he will no longer be posting on Twitter. And nothing of value was lost. This is episode 676 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, November 1st, 2020. I am the Solo Monster. 13 years to the month that I started this show. We are celebrating the anniversary of the Sound Off all month long in November. I got half a dozen emails and some tweets. Got a lot of messages this week from people telling me, make sure that you watch the NXT UK Championship match between Walter, right, Volta, and Ilya Dragunov from NXT UK. Which I was planning on doing anyway. I mean, if you remember, I talked a couple of weeks ago about the tag team match that took place. It was Dragunov and Pete Dunne against Walter and Alexander Wolfe. So I already knew this match was coming up. I was looking forward to watching this match. I finally did. And in a word, there's a lot of words you could use to describe this match. One of the words that I would use is uncomfortable. Uncomfortable, but in a good way. It was brutality to the point of being uncomfortable. And that was the point. You know, Dragunov was trying to do what nobody else has been able to do, and that is beat the final boss. You know, that being Walter. He pinned him in that tag team match 2 weeks ago, but nobody has been able to pin Walter one-on-one. Nobody has been able to submit him. Nobody has been able to dethrone him as the United Kingdom champion. And in the end, Dragunov fell short. But if you are a fan of Japanese strong style, for example, well, this was British strong style on display here, even though neither of these men are actually British, right? You've got one Russian, one Austrian. But there has never been a stiffer, more harder-hitting match, I don't think. I was trying to think, what other match in WWE comes to mind that would match this for the intensity and the stiffness overall? And I couldn't think of one that tops what I saw here. This was the hardest hitting match, I think, in WWE history. And Dragunov's, his chest was purple by the time it was over. His back and his upper shoulders were red with welts all over them. His mouth was bloody. And it wasn't just the chops. I mean, it wasn't just a chop fest, although there was a lot of that. But, I mean, the lariats that these guys were throwing, they were trying to take each other's heads off. Both of them. This was brutal. This was violent. This was a fight contested under pro wrestling rules with a predetermined winner. That's really what it was. It was a fight. But it was a fight that both guys going in knew who the winner was going to be. Now, this match in front of a live audience, this match would have had people coming out of their seats like Walter and Tyler Bate, that match they had last year. But they worked this inside of an empty studio. And I actually think, while obviously a packed crowd would have been better, but I think that the empty building environment actually enhanced this match in a way. You could hear every chop, every strike, every violent scream echoed in a way that it would not have if you had a few thousand people in the building. You could always hear a Walter chop. I mean, it doesn't matter how many people are in the building. You could have 10,000 people in the building. You could hear his chops, you could hear from anywhere. You can hear him from the upper deck. But here you could hear everything. Dragunov just gave this guy everything he had. It was not enough. Ilya Dragunov is going to be a world champion one day. He is that good. But today is not that day. So set aside 30 minutes of your day to watch this match. It is in the conversation for match of the year. Some people already have it as their match of the year, but it's definitely in that conversation. Now, interestingly, Walter tweeted that he would no longer be competing in the WXW promotion in Germany, at least not on a regular basis. That was really the promotion he's called his home now for a number of years. And he also said that he would be disbanding Ringkampf, which was one of the more popular groups on the independent scene for the last 5 years or so that he was part of. What that means for his WWE future, he did not say. But it would not be a stretch to surmise from that, and again, this is just me spitballing here, that perhaps Walter may be coming to the States, and perhaps he could even be NXT-bound instead of just NXT UK. You know, as a fan, Walter in NXT and not NXT UK would open up a host of new opponents and programs for him. I mean, the story on him has always been that he never wanted to move to America, which, I mean, who the hell could blame him right now? I mean, the guy was working a date in Chicago last year and had his rental car broken into and had his passport stolen. I think his title belt was stolen. So I'm sure that didn't help. But if he has changed his tune, or Triple H made him an offer that he couldn't refuse, and he comes, you know, down to Orlando to go to work at the COVID Coliseum, that would be awesome. I mean, I have no interest in seeing him on Raw or SmackDown. It's just never going to work. It's not because I wouldn't want to see him. It's just that it would never work. Never. Vince McMahon would take one look at this guy, and he would look at him, and he would see a fat guy in trunks. And you know it's true. His big moment at Survivor Series last year, remember he was in the elimination match, was being the first man eliminated in under 3 minutes. That is the fate that awaits him. So I don't want to hear anything about main roster stuff. But if he comes to NXT, that would make it easier to get the match with Finn Balor. They were going to do that, I think, at the Dublin Takeover show earlier this year. We never did get to see that. It would make that match a lot easier to do. So they've done right by him in NXT UK. And I think they would in NXT as well. Anything else, it's only a matter of time before this guy is Kozlov 2.0. But we'll have to wait and see. Again, he didn't give any more information as far as what that means, but I thought him posting that announcement on his Twitter was very interesting, and he's only doing that if there's some other move that's being made. What that move ends up being, we'll have to wait and see. Definitely show some love for Audible, which is a big sponsor of the podcast each and every week. They've been very loyal. They've been with us for a long time, offering you one free audiobook of your choice when you use our link, audibletrial.com/solemonster. You can sign up for a 30-day trial of the service, get one free book of your choice, any book you want. Could be a wrestling book, could be a non-wrestling book. There are lots of them. In fact, there are tens upon tens of thousands to choose from. And even if you cancel your trial before the 30 days are up, you get to keep your book no matter what. audibletrial.com/solemonster. Get yourself a free book courtesy of The Sound Off, and if you want to make a PayPal donation, you may do so on thesolemonster.com. You'll see the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page. $10 or more for a nickname and a shout-out. $30 or more if you want to shout-out your podcast, channel, or what have you. Thank you to the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Killshot Keith Hart, Fast Blast Tim Banks, Billy Hardcore Habibi, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Stephen Handyman Halistick, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep. Gotta show some love to our MJG Chick, who left a very nice iTunes review, very helpful 5-star iTunes review for the show. And the Sound Off Group Messiah, Jeff Lippman, Jeff and Shaw host a podcast together that you guys need to check out. It is called the Garden of Doom podcast. It is a variety magazine that explores the unexplained, the abnormal, science, pop culture, current events, and a dose of fun. In his words, a dose of fun. I like how Jeff mentioned, and a dose of fun, as if the rest of the show is not fun. It is. Come on, man. You gotta sell it, man. Come on. Come on, Jeff. Glengarry Glen Ross. Always be closing. You gotta sell it. If you like myths, comics, sci-fi, fantasy, you will want to take up some gardening on the Garden of Doom podcast. Check it out on Apple Podcasts, Spreaker, and all of the major podcast platforms. So we have more shout-outs coming up in a bit. But I want to mention the death of Tracy Smothers. Tracy Smothers passed away on Wednesday at the age of 58. He was diagnosed with lymphoma last year, and he had some heart issues as a result. He just had a hernia operation, so he was in rough shape for the past year or so. Not a name who ever really hit it big on the national stage, or at least as big as he probably should have. I mean, the outpouring of love and support that this man has received this week caught me by surprise. You know, I knew he was well-liked. I knew he was still, you know, visible on the independent scene, always willing to help people out, a very affable guy by all accounts. But you really realized when you see all the tweets and the messages and the Facebook posts and tributes that poured in for this guy, how it just spanned generations. It was multi-generational from the people he worked with back in the 80s and the 90s, you know, kind of the old crew, to a lot of the newer generation who were familiar with him, shared a locker room with him, worked with him, got advice from him on the independent scene. CM Punk had some really nice words to say about him. A lot of people did. Punk was hardly the only one, although maybe one of the bigger names. But he left an incredible mark on the wrestling business, but never really had that big national run. I mean, he had runs. He was a tag team wrestler in WCW in the early 90s. Smoky Mountain Wrestling, working for Jim Cornette. Brief run, really used as a job guy, but a brief run in WWE. And ECW as well. He worked for Paul Heyman. Jim Cornette called him the heart of Smoky Mountain. Jim Cornette did the foreword for Tracy's book. His autobiography, it first came out a few months ago, earlier this year, and Cornette had written the foreword, or one of the forewords for the book, and called him the, you know, the heart and soul, really, of Smoky Mountain. And he was really their main star there during the SMW run. Cornette is the one who got him a job in WWE in 1996 when they brought him in as Freddie Joe Floyd. I mean, this whole period in around 95, 96. And they brought in all these different people. They brought in Freddie Joe Floyd, and T.L. Hopper was the plumber, and they had Alex the Pug Porteau, who was the amateur wrestler, and the Goon, who Chris Jericho, I think, says was the gimmick they wanted for him, and he said no, and they gave it to Bill Irwin instead. But they brought in, and Duke the Dumpster, Drozzy, all these people I remember they brought in around the same time. Freddie Joe Floyd was just sort of the underdog guy. He was never really used for anything other than to put other people over. And so, you know, unfortunately for him, probably coming out of that run, a lot of people looked at him as like a jobber, like an enhancement talent and nothing more. But he had a lot of success prior to that as you know, a real star in the business. But that's not how WWE saw him. That's not how they used him. In ECW, you know, you had the Southern boy from Tennessee as a member of the full-blooded Italians. He had to go out there and pretend to be Italian, which was comical. But, you know, he's been a mainstay on the independent scene ever since. And it was very sad to see that he lost his battle, but it's very telling to see the level of support and messages that he got. Again, it just spans young and old. And clearly he left his mark on the business. There's no doubt about it. There was more news this week on the situation involving WWE telling its talent that they would need to shut down or surrender control of their Twitch accounts. This was a big story about a month ago. Vince McMahon had supposedly imposed a deadline by which they would have to do it. I thought that deadline was early in October, but apparently it was this past week, because there were a whole bunch of stars who tearfully said goodbye this week to their followers, at least temporarily. And it was very obvious that they were doing so against their own will. This was not something they wanted to do. They were very upset. They were very sad. PW Insider reported that a lot of the talents recently met face-to-face with Vince McMahon to try to talk him out of this and try to argue why this was a bad idea. But obviously, given what happened here, whatever they tried to do, it did not change his mind. It did not work. AJ Styles, right? He's known for going on his Twitch. Before it was Mixer, now it's Twitch. Going on his Twitch, sometimes with his son, and streaming and answering Q&A and playing games. He wrote this to his community on Twitch. He said, "I want to thank all of you for the great memories on Mixer and Twitch. I will cherish these memories, and I love every one of you that have made this possible and supported me. As many of you, WWE is making changes that involve streaming. We will see what the future holds in that regard. With that being said, I will be suspending Styles Clash stream. This is not goodbye, but this is see you sometime in the future. We will leave Discord open, but it will not be monitored as we will be making changes. Again, this is not the end. It is just a pause. Thank you again for your support." And you know what's telling about that statement? I did hear that Vince McMahon was supposedly going to have a meeting with people on Friday, I guess backstage at SmackDown, to try to better explain the situation and what's going on. I have not heard anything coming out of that alleged meeting, if the meeting even happened. So it's possible in the next few days there'll be word that leaks if there is further clarification on what the hell is going on here. You read AJ's statement, even he sounds like he doesn't know what's going on. He says it himself, he's not sure what the future holds as far as what their plans are for streaming. So I think as much as anything, what's probably bothering these people, and it would bother me too, is that they're still kind of in the dark about why this is happening or exactly what WWE's plans are going forward for their channels. But AJ was not the only one to shut down his Twitch stream. Mia Yim, also very upset, had to, as she said, I think, temporarily, right? This is not permanent, but for now, we have to end this. She did a lot of charity streaming on her channel. Cesaro had to shut down his. Aleister Black and Zelina Vega were very upset. I believe Xavier Woods as well. That was separate from his Up Up Down Down channel on YouTube, which I'm almost positive WWE has a piece of because they promote the damn thing so much. I don't see how they don't have a piece of that already. But I think he may have had a separate Twitch that he also had to either shut down or kind of put on the side here temporarily. But the most outspoken of all of the WWE talents, contracted talents, was Paige, who has a huge following on Twitch, probably the biggest of any of the WWE stars. I've seen estimates, if these are accurate, of what she potentially makes on Twitch. I've seen figures ranging anywhere from $30,000 a month to as much as $50,000 a month. Look, if I was pulling in even 30 grand a month, I wouldn't want to give up my Twitch either. I don't blame her. But Paige got very emotional the other night live on her stream. She ran the gamut of emotions from sadness to anger. I don't know if she's quite reached the acceptance stage yet, but she was all over the place. She was crying at one point. She was in tears. Said that she had gotten to the point where she honestly cannot even deal with this company anymore. That was in reference to WWE. These are some of the comments that she said. I think she may have also set the Guinness World Record for the greatest number of F-bombs dropped in a 2 or 3 minute span. My father, let me tell you something. My father was a truck driver. He had a very colorful vocabulary. I think even he would blush if he had watched this Paige stream the other night. But yeah, again, when you're very emotional and everything is very raw, it just kind of pours out. I don't know if she's like that on every stream, but anyway, this is what she said. She said, "Now I have to make a very important decision." She says, "I'm effing tired. I broke my effing neck twice for this company. over effing, I'll just say it, over fucking, why am I censoring myself? Over fucking worked. This is not a PG show. That I broke my neck twice for this company. They don't realize that this community is not about subs. We build a community and a family where this is an escape for a lot of people, including myself. I can't wrestle anymore. I was worked so hard in WWE that I can't wrestle anymore because my neck is fucked. My dreams got taken away. I had to have something that fulfilled this huge fucking void that I lost with wrestling. I could not wrestle anymore. Something that I have lived and breathed since I was a fetus. And it got ripped away from me. I had to find something I could fill that little bit of that with, and Twitch was a wonderful thing for me. It is such a wonderful place for me. I am an injured wrestler. I get used for media stuff sometimes, but at the end of the day, I am in my house going fucking crazy. And I need something to keep me sane. Twitch was my escape. Right now, I'm just sitting on my ass. People think that I should be thankful that I still have a fucking job. And I am, but it doesn't mean that I should be treated like fucking shit. I had my neck broken and taken away from me twice. You can't take away my Twitch as well. I'm going to keep streaming. We'll see how that goes. What is the pocket change that we are getting compared to the billions that these people are getting? We're not hurting anybody or doing anything harmful. We're just having a good time. People are on YouTube, have merchandise, wrestling schools, and Twitch gets taken down. Now, she also claims that she has spoken to a lawyer about unionization. Now, she has brought up the unionization issue a few times now, although I think, honestly, I think it's probably more, and I don't doubt that she's probably spoken to a lawyer about this, but I think this is more just about her being angry, and she's not necessarily going to do anything about it. It could just be her lashing out at the company as a way of saying, hey, back off. Don't go down this road. Don't push me. Which, if that's the case, clearly that hasn't worked. But yeah, she talked multiple times about having broken her neck twice for the company. And I completely understand where she's coming from. This is a woman who was born into the wrestling business. You know, if we talk about wrestling families, you think of the Hart family, you think of the Guerreros, you think of the Von Erichs, the Samoan dynasty, the Armstrong family. It's a lot of wrestling families. And the Knight family, you know, over in England, is one of those families. They did a whole movie about them, did a whole documentary about them many years ago. You can find that on YouTube. This is a woman, you know, in Paige, who was wrestling from a very young age. So she was born into the business. It's in her blood. It's part of who she is. And it's probably the only thing that she's ever known and the only thing that she's ever really even imagined doing. Now imagine, you're as young as she is. I don't know how old she is now, but when she broke her neck the first time, she was in her early 20s. And she's not that much older than that now. And she broke her neck, and it's not just that she broke her neck, and I think she finally, you know, she came to the realization that I should not be getting in the ring, to where I think if she was not under contract to WWE, I don't know that she's going to go run off to an independent or some other company and then wrestle. I think she realizes that that would not be a smart thing for her to do physically. But whether or not she has dreams of one day wrestling again, never say never, right? People said Daniel Bryan would never wrestle again. Edge is never going to wrestle again. Both of them came back. And really, in both cases, I guess more so it was concussions with Bryan, although he had neck issues as well. Never say never about Paige wrestling again. But the company made it very clear that you're not going to wrestle for us because we are not going to clear you. You are not medically cleared. You will likely never be medically cleared. So imagine you're under contract to this company and you're still a very young person. In your mind, I could still physically go out there and do this. And now the company is telling you why, wisely, WWE is correct in saying that not only because you're a liability to us if we allow you back in the ring, but because it could be catastrophic to you and your health, we're not going to allow you to wrestle. So we have you locked under contract, but you can't do the one thing that you've always wanted to do. You can't do the one thing that you love more than anything else in the world. We are telling you, you cannot do that. The answer is no. So what does she do? She goes off and she finds this Twitch thing. And I've seen people saying, oh, what does she do on Twitch? All she does is sit there and answer some questions, but then she just wants subs. And when she says it's about not about subs, she's lying. Look, whatever her motivations are, whatever she does on her channel is her business. If there are people out there who are willing to buy subs and support her because they're a fan of hers, then that's their prerogative. And if this woman is bringing in tens of thousands of dollars a month on Twitch, and that is her outlet now, that's her creative outlet, this is what she does to occupy herself because she doesn't know what else to do. And then WWE says, well, we're going to take that away from you. Or, yeah, maybe, you know, we'll take control and maybe you can still stream, but we're going to give you a fraction of what you were making. You still go do all the work, but we're going to take half or more than half of what you were making. If they want to take that away from her, in her mind, they already took one thing away from her. So I totally understand why she would be upset, and I sympathize with her. I agree with her. It is cruel for WWE to basically say, okay, you can't do this one thing anymore. You got hurt working on our watch, and now we're telling you you're not allowed to do this anymore. But this other thing that you decided to get into, yeah, we want a piece of that too. Or, you know what, you can't do that anymore. You could understand why she would be upset. Now, yesterday on her stream, she's still streaming. She struck a little bit of a different tone. She seemed like she was in a better place. But she insisted that she is going to continue streaming. This is what she said. She said, the fact that you guys are so supportive is wonderful and made me feel so much happier and so much better. So yes, I am going to keep doing what I'm doing because, you know, I don't have a lot going on, you guys. I really don't. I feel really happy today because of all the support that was given. I don't have a lot going on. This is really special to me. I'm always one who speaks my mind. It's kind of bittersweet because I can get in trouble for being honest and having an opinion. I like to stand up for what's right. Not just for me, but for everybody. And she went on after that. But that was basically the crux of her message. So I don't know if she had some kind of discussion with anybody in WWE. I'm guessing not. She has made the choice to continue streaming and let's see what happens. You know, allegedly Vince McMahon said that if people don't adhere to the deadline and they continue to do what they're doing, they face the penalty of fines, suspension, or termination. And I think that maybe, you know, her mindset on this may also, and again, I don't think she's wrong on this either. WWE is walking a very thin line here. They're on very thin ice, I think, when it comes to Paige. Because there's a lot of people, I think, who can sympathize with her situation, like I just talked about. We know there's interest from Andrew Yang and certain outside forces who may soon either have power or may have the ear of somebody who has power. And Yang, you know, for example, is a wrestling fan. This is not something I think that he necessarily is going to let go of. So now you've attracted interest from outside forces who are already threatening and making comments about, you know, looking into this and taking action in some way against WWE. Here you have this young woman who can't wrestle anymore. She's streaming on Twitch. And in her mind, maybe she figures, look, what are they going to do to me? Are they going to fire me? Can you imagine the shitstorm if WWE suspended her without pay or fired her? The shitstorm that would kick up for them of bad publicity, of unwanted publicity, because that's all this company is about. It's all about good publicity. It's all about good PR. That would not be very good PR. So maybe she's just, you know, weighing the pros and cons and saying, look, what's the worst that happens? Maybe she doesn't want to quit, but she wouldn't mind if they fired her. I don't know. I don't know how much more money she may be making in WWE than she's making on Twitch. For all I know, she could be making more money on Twitch than she is working for WWE. I would think not, which is why she said the other night, I have a decision to make. If she was making so much more money on Twitch, I don't see there being much of a decision to make. You tell WWE to go fuck off, and you keep streaming. So it could very well be a case where, as well as she's doing on there, WWE, her deal, is more lucrative. I don't know. Only she knows the details of that. The belief is that WWE is planning on entering into a partnership of their own with Twitch, and the talent would receive a percentage. How much of a percentage, we don't know. Doesn't seem like they know either. But it would count against their downside guarantee. I already talked about this last month. That's why a lot of the wrestlers were very upset when they found out it would count against their downside. Now, it makes sense that WWE would not want people using their stage names. I actually agree with that. I understand that. And if Aleister Black was going to stream as Aleister Black, then he can't stream as Aleister Black. He would have to stream under his real name. Same for anybody else. If that was the issue that WWE had, then I actually think that that's completely reasonable, and I understand that. But all this other stuff about, well, it doesn't matter whether you're using your real name or your stage name, you know, even if the language in the contracts that they signed is such that, you know, WWE can legally do this, that doesn't make it right. Just because you can legally do something doesn't make it right. It's wrong. What they are doing is wrong. Now, what do I think WWE has planned here? I think that they're going to launch their own Twitch channel. And a couple of things. Either they would have the one Twitch channel, and they would have a rotating schedule of talent who at set times during the week would basically be required to stream, because that was part of the story as well. The way WWE looks at this, and one of the reasons the wrestlers were upset, is that it would count now as work. So not only would they surrender control, creative control, of their own channels, and at least some of the revenue they were bringing in, but now it's considered work. And WWE would dictate when they stream and when they don't stream. So I could see the one WWE channel, hoping that all these wrestlers will bring all their fans and their subs over to the one consolidated channel, and they would have different people streaming at designated times, and they would get a small cut of that, however they work that out. Or they would allow these people to keep their channel separate, and they would just get a cut from those individual channels. But I mean, the way that Paige, for example, cusses on her channel, I don't see any way that, she would last a day streaming on the official WWE Twitch channel. I'm not sure that would really work out. But that's really all we know at this point. I think it sucks, the position they put some of these wrestlers in. You know, I understand that they probably get paid very well by WWE. They probably get paid, especially a guy like AJ Styles, right? I'm sure he's making bank. I'm sure he's making very good money for WWE. But I do think that in a lot of these cases, you know, yeah, they may make money off their own channels, but they look at it as an outlet. It's their way of sort of interacting with their fans, and whether they're doing Q&As or playing games, whatever it may be, it's something outside of WWE. It's not dictated by them. It's not scripted by them. You know what I mean? There's no rules and regulations that they have to follow. And now WWE is taking that away from them. And the question becomes, can they do this? Everyone seems to think, well, they can. The language in the contract says that they can. We don't know the language in each of their contracts. There's no language in those contracts that talks about Twitch. So, you know, we're in a bit of uncharted territory here. And my opinion is the same now as it was a month ago. It's nice that Paige seems to be very vocal about this, and she can talk about, oh, unionization. She can mention that all she wants. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to take people standing up and having a set of balls on them. I mean, it seems like Paige has bigger balls than most of the men and the other people who work in WWE. Because nobody wants to make a fuss about this and get in trouble or risk their job and stand up publicly and say anything. And it shouldn't just be one person. It shouldn't just be Paige. It should be, you should have at least half a dozen people standing up together, banding together and saying, this is bullshit and we're not going to stand for it. You want to fire us? Fire all six of us, all eight of us, all 10 of us. Strength in numbers. And they just don't seem to have the guts to do so. And so as long as they don't want to stand up for themselves, this is the sort of thing that's going to continue to happen. I mean, I have sympathy for someone like Paige, but my sympathy only goes so far. If they're not willing to stand up for themselves, you know, then what the hell are we so concerned about? They've got to want to stand up and say something themselves. Until they do that, nothing is going to change. Vince McMahon, is coming to Netflix, or at least a docuseries about Vince McMahon is coming to Netflix. During WWE's earnings call on Thursday, they announced that they have reached a groundbreaking deal to produce a multi-part documentary on the life of Vince McMahon, which is said to be one of the highest budgeted documentaries in Netflix history. So I guess now we know why GLOW died. You see, Vince McMahon killed the gorgeous ladies of wrestling. It's the highest budgeted documentary, so you take some of that money and give it back to GLOW so we can get that final season. No word yet on when the series will be debuting, but Bill Simmons will serve as the executive producer. He was also a producer on the Andre the Giant documentary that aired on HBO. WWE was involved in that one as well. And since they're going to be involved in this one, look, I'm going to watch it. I think it may be entertaining. But if WWE is involved here, you're going to get the portrayal of Vince McMahon that they want you to see. You are not going to get a wholly accurate portrayal of the man that is Vince McMahon. You know this already. If WWE has its hands involved and final approval and all that, you're going to get the version that they want you to see. It's not going to be a completely legitimate documentary on the life and times of Vince McMahon. Netflix also, don't forget, has a business relationship with WWE. So there's going to be enough fluff in this thing to fill a few thousand pillowcases. And Chris Smith, who directed the Fyre Festival documentary on Netflix, he is going to be directing this one as well. Ah, yes. Good old Andy King, always willing to take one for the team. That also happens to be how some of the wrestlers got their pushes on WWE television in the 80s and the early 90s. But that's for another documentary. Dark Side of the Ring is filming season 3 right now. That one would be more appropriate for Dark Side of the Ring. Some more shout-outs here. You guys support the show. You keep the show going. I thank you all. Mean Matt Forbush, thank you for the support. Josh the Shooter Stockton. Stormy Skies, Ryan Spies, The Fire Bomber, Craig Foster, Night Stalker, Naif Al-Safar, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Dark Sky, Dixon Krasinski, and The Guardian Angel, Jacob Donnelly. Belt fan Brent Banner wants everybody to check out his How Did We Even Get Here podcast. This week, he and his co-host Trey discussed the absurdity of the Fast and the Furious movies, what they think sucks about Montez Ford, and love lessons that they learned in their 20s. You can find them on all podcast outlets. Just search How Did We Even Get Here, or you can go to tinyurl.com/gethere-tube. NXT brought back Halloween Havoc on Wednesday night. That was for the first time in 20 years that we got a Halloween Havoc show. We're going to do things a little bit differently this week and get into NXT first, because it was the best of all the WWE shows this week. So even if you didn't watch it, listen to this review. I think once we're done here, you might want to take some time to go back, once you've watched that NXT UK match I recommended, and check out this show, because I thought it was excellent. NXT has now resurrected War Games, the Great American Bash, after WWE had abandoned it. And did what they do best, by the way, which is cut off first names. Oh yeah, we're going to talk about that in a little bit too. Remember, it went from Great American Bash to just The Bash. Vince McMahon has this fetish about getting rid of first names. But NXT resurrected that, and now Halloween Havoc. And if you watched the show on Wednesday, you know why I've been asking for it for all these years. Because it is just fun. NXT had fun with the theme. They put a lot of work into the look of the show, the feel, the set, the props, the costumes, and it made for the best NXT television show all year. We are now officially in November, right? Put takeovers aside, this was the best NXT TV show all year in 2020. This was a really fun show. It was better than this week's Dynamite. And I enjoyed Dynamite. I thought Dynamite was good, but Halloween Havoc, I thought Halloween Havoc knocked it out of the water. I thought Halloween Havoc was the more enjoyable show of the two. And they were rewarded for it in the ratings. A rare win for NXT over AEW, 876,000 viewers. to Dynamite's 781,000 viewers, although AEW still charted better than NXT in the key demo. AEW came in at number 12, and NXT still could not crack the top 20. But with how well this theme show did, do not be surprised. Do not be surprised to see maybe a Thanksgiving-themed NXT show or a Christmas-themed NXT show. I like the theme shows. I don't like the themed pay-per-views like Hell in a Cell and TLC. That I don't like. But a holiday theme show? See, when WWE does like a Christmas show, usually it's just, it's way too cheesy. It's just, you know, they have some of the gifts on the stage and a couple of Christmas trees and somebody comes out dressed as Santa and whatever. Usually it's just completely cheesy. So you got to be careful what you wish for. It depends how you do it. But I think a theme show could be fun, like this one, if done correctly. Now, there were reports of another COVID outbreak at the Performance Center the previous Friday, and people were asked to quarantine for 2 weeks. Thankfully, it did not impact the Havoc card. All of the scheduled matches went on as planned. One NXT star, Bronson Reed, tweeted, "If I have learned anything from this pandemic, it is that a lot of people are real selfish pieces of trash." That is what you call putting people on blast without actually shaming them publicly. Shame away, big men. Don't hold back. Halloween Havoc was a prime example of how much custom sets can really add to a show. Outside of WrestleMania, WWE really does not invest much anymore, which is weird because they're making more money than ever before, and they've gotten more frugal when it comes to their pay-per-view sets. Definitely not as creative with them as they used to be. This was not a pay-per-view, but they went all out, you know, inside the COVID Coliseum down there to really take full advantage of the Halloween theme. And right down to the orange ring ropes, which was a nice touch. And yes, they busted out the inflatable pumpkin, not the original one, they made their own, but they busted out an inflatable pumpkin, which Johnny the Prick Gargano immediately cut a hole in at the start of the show, and he deflated the damn thing. Vic Joseph was dressed up as Waldo. Wade Barrett was dressed up as Bad News Barrett, which is just Wade Barrett with a gavel in his hand. Shotzi Blackheart had 4 wardrobe changes on this show, one of which paid tribute to Elvira. Johnny Gargano is the new North American champion, the first man to ever hold that title on 2 separate occasions. Spin the Wheel, Make the Deal landed on Devil's Playground with Gargano and Damian Priest, which was basically a Falls Count Anywhere match, anything goes. Johnny, as I mentioned, he deflated the giant pumpkin when he came out. He shanked the damn thing. It broke my heart. Reminded me of when Bayley went heel and she cut holes with a knife or a box cutter in the Bayley Buddies, the Wacky Wailing Inflatable Tube Men, or Wacky Waving, I should say, Inflatable Tube Men. And then watching them deflate, it's like my heart was deflating at the same time. Priest got the live guitar entrance, which gave this takeover vibes. Just gave this a very takeover-esque feel. See, I'm old enough to remember when Code Orange performed Aleister Black's theme live at TakeOver. And it was one of the coolest entrances that I've ever seen. How do you fuck up Aleister Black is the question that I want to know. How did Aleister Black go from that to where he is now? It is a crime. If crimes against humanity were punishable in the WWE universe, Vince McMahon would be tried in The Hague. Someone dressed in a Ghostface costume from the movie Scream hit Priest with a pipe and then handed a headstone to Gargano, who smashed Priest with it. Priest went tumbling off this elevated platform where the wheel was. Went tumbling off the balcony, the platform, where, you know, down below there was a Halloween set, so he fell through that. There was dust all over him and debris, and he was knocked out, and eventually Gargano crawled down, and he covered him, and he won the championship. So I thought it was a fun match, And a nice little swerve, too, because I thought for sure that after this, Candice was going to win the women's title from Io later on in the show. And that did not happen. So that was, I mean, for me anyway, that was a little bit of a swerve. I love seeing Ghostface. My first thought on who it could be under the mask, because they didn't reveal who it was, which pretty much means it could be anybody, right? They could put anybody under the costume on one night. Maybe they're still trying to figure out who it is. That's kind of the whole Black Scorpion thing back in the day in WCW, right? The Black Scorpion would come out, and then in the end it was Ric Flair. You know, it wasn't Ric Flair under that costume until the night that he was exposed. I was thinking about, okay, who is supposed to be under the Ghostface mask and the cloak? Who's it going to be? My first thought was Austin Theory. Now, Austin Theory, he quit, quote unquote. He quit the week before, but he also had that real competitive match on TV a few weeks ago with Gargano. Maybe Johnny is going to take him under his wing. Maybe Johnny said, hey, this kid is, he's losing all of his matches. He's down in the dumps. He's quit. You know what? I'm going to swoop in. I'm going to be his knight in shining armor. I'm going to rescue this kid. I could use him. He could be useful to me. He impressed me in the match that we had a few weeks ago. And so maybe he's recruited Austin Theory. You know, Johnny respects the hustle. He sees something in the kid. Now, I did see a report that Indy Hartwell, who has been assisting Candice in recent weeks, that she was supposed to get involved in that women's match later in the show, but she was taken off the show. I don't know why she was taken off the show. You know what? Who says it's only one person under the mask? Why couldn't it be Indy Hartwell, you know, who came out later in the show, and Austin Theory, who came out in the costume at the beginning of the show? Why can't it be both? Remember the original Scream, I mean, spoiler, but in the original Scream, we had two killers working together. We had two people at different times under the Ghostface mask. I think it's probably going to be the same thing here. That's my prediction. Pat McAfee appeared with the new NXT Tag Team Champions, Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch. McAfee, he's such a natural heel. He really is. This is the perfect role for him. You know, he'll get physical and maybe wrestle a match here and there where he has to, but he's there as a personality. He's there as the spokesman, the manager, the agent for these guys to lead his own group. And he is perfect in this role. He healed on Adam Cole. He healed on the fans. I did think there were too many mentions of the internet wrestling community. Yes, he did say in those exact words, he talked about the internet wrestling community. Anytime anybody talks about the internet wrestling community on television, it just makes me seize up. I'm cringing so hard, it makes me seize. Anytime I hear somebody say IWC, it makes me seize. It just makes no sense. It's a stupid term. The internet wrestling community. What does that even mean? Every wrestling fan is on the internet. There's got to be a better way to describe it. It is such a stupid, dated term. It doesn't even make any sense. But when I hear wrestlers, and this would, I haven't heard anybody on AEW say this, although I could easily see it one day, cringeworthy. And after the first time he mentioned that, I thought that was enough. He mentioned it another couple of times. I don't need to be hearing about the internet wrestling community on TV. But he bragged about paying off Ridge Holland with a Mercedes-Benz to attack Adam Cole. He could have bribed him with a Mercedes Martinez. Could have ended up with Ridge Holland and Mercedes Martinez as an item on TV. But when he got hurt, when Ridge got hurt, McAfee decided to go after the guy who took out his guy, and that was Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch. And Kyle O'Reilly comes out. He was all alone. No other member of Undisputed Era was there, so out comes Kyle. And then out comes Pete Dunne, making his first NXT appearance in months. Now, when he came back to NXT UK a couple of weeks ago, he looked like he was in the best shape of his life. He walked out there looking like a new man. He looks great. He had a chair in his hand. He offered one to O'Reilly. But then he hit Kyle in the back with it, and he turned heel. He joined up with Lorcan and Burch and McAfee, stomped the crap out of Kyle O'Reilly. Pete Dunne is at his best as a heel. and NXT just got a key player back on their roster. So this could not have been better timing. It is the perfect role for him. I don't know that they need another member right now, but if they wanted a fifth man in this group, I would make Timothy Thatcher that man. I think Thatcher would fit like a glove with those other guys. I just don't know that they need him, because McAfee is, he's leading the group, but I think McAfee, like if they're thinking war games, I'm sure he's going to wrestle. That's usually what, 4-on-4. So I don't even know that they need another man right now. They have their man. They have their man in Pete Dunne. You got McAfee, you got one singles guy, and you got a tag team. But they needed a team for war games against Undisputed Era if they're going to do war games. I'm really hoping that if they do, we get the two rings and not just one. But if they're going to do war games, now you've got your four. You've got McAfee, you've got Dunne, you've got Lorcan, you've got Birch. And Dunne gets the spot that would have gone to Ridge Holland. The prospect of doing Finn Balor against Pete Dunne for the NXT Championship sometime in the next few months is very enticing. Dunne could bring the big gold to Team McAfee. I thought Santos Escobar beating Jake Atlas was the weakest thing on the show, not because it was a bad match, it was a 3-minute match, but I just enjoyed everything else so much more. Case in point, we got a cinematic match. WWE loves doing their cinematic matches, and sometimes it works, and sometimes maybe it doesn't. And they've done cinematic matches even before this year. When I say that sometimes it doesn't, the first thing that popped in my head was the House of Horrors match between Bray Wyatt and Randy Orton, which was very similar to what we got here. This was a Haunted House of Terror match. So very similar. Only here it was Cameron Grimes and Dexter Lumis. And I enjoyed this infinitely more than I did that Randy Orton-Bray Wyatt match from a few years ago. Cameron Grimes was fantastic here. Regal lied to him. Well, he didn't really lie to him. He wouldn't give him a lot of information. Cameron Grimes was desperate for information. Where are we going? You know, what are the rules of the match? Regal led him outside the building. He said, there's going to be a van waiting for you. And so he, you know, Grimes is scared to death. He goes outside, not knowing where this van is even taking him. And here comes this white van that pulls up with some strange-looking guy in the front seat. All of a sudden, the van door is open, and who emerges but Michael Hayes. And blaring in the background is Bad Street USA. And out comes Michael Hayes. I would say that he was in his Halloween costume, but that's just how he dresses all the time. I don't know who dresses this man in the morning. But yes, very, very questionable fashion sense here for Michael Hayes. And he just goes walking off. So it was just he goes walking off into the darkness. And we never saw him again. But remember, Johnny Gargano has a picture on his wall at home of Doc Hendricks. So there is no bigger Michael Hayes fan in NXT than Johnny Gargano. But Cameron Grimes gets in the van and off it goes to an undisclosed location. He ended up in this creepy little house. There was a deer head on the wall that freaked him out. And then there was this tricycle that was riding itself. It was moving on its own. They had zombies and a referee dressed as a zombie. I laughed when Grimes was asking the zombie ref. He goes, how do you win this match? Could you win this match by pinfall or submission? He desperately wanted to know what the rules of the match were. Nobody would tell him. And after some fighting in various rooms, Grimes tried to flee in a car outside. Lumis, though, was in the driver's seat, so he got out of the car. And Grimes just started running through the woods. And we got a message that said, to be continued. Later on in the show, they cut. We see Cameron Grimes ran all the way back. I don't know how he found his way, but he ran all the way back to the CWC. He collapsed inside. Once he was inside, he collapsed from exhaustion in this makeshift graveyard. Then the zombie lady crawled out from one of the graves. Now, they either hired a yoga instructor for this, or one of the trainees down there is the female version of Gumby. This woman was bending and just every which way. Most flexible person I've ever seen. I'm sure she's a lot of fun. More zombies appeared. Then Loomis surprised Grimes in the ring. They had the smoke machines working, so you had smoke. Like, they got the vibe here just right. They really did. They got the vibe here just right. Loomis press slammed him onto the he press slammed one of the zombies onto Grimes. I think it was the woman. And then he choked him out, and that was it. Dexter Loomis gets the win. They flashed a message on the screen that said, "The end." Total cheese, but I loved it. I cannot think of another NXT star who has changed my mind on him faster than Cameron Grimes. His work has always been great in the ring, but his character just bored the hell out of me. From the moment I would hear his music, and I'm like, oh God, just didn't do anything for me. And now I find him to be one of the most entertaining parts of the show for me every single week. See, that is the importance of character development. This is a guy who knows his character, he's mastered it, he's embraced it, and I just think he is maybe the most entertaining part of the entire show. I thought Rhea Ripley and Raquel Gonzalez tore it up. Both women's matches, I think, did on this show. NXT has the best women's division right now in any major promotion in this country. And these two showed why they are a very big part of that. Rhea won with the Riptide. It did not come easy. This was Gonzalez's best match to date. And it's not often that we see two ladies on the show having as physical a match as these two had. That does not involve ladders and chairs and kendo sticks and weapons of all kinds. So I loved it. Thought they had a great match. Drake Maverick was dressed up as Hulk Hogan. Someone showed up dressed up as the Giant from WCW, and then someone else came in dressed up as the Yeti, and they sandwiched Maverick to recreate one of the worst scenes in WCW history, the Hogan hump scene from Halloween Havoc 1995. This is the 25-year anniversary, by the way. Killian Dane, he entered the scene wearing the Shockmaster helmet, the glittery Stormtrooper Shockmaster helmet. And then the Giant bailed, the Yeti, or the Yeti bailed. This was all happening in the back, by the way, not in the ring. This was just a backstage segment. Maverick was very upset that Dane did not trip and fall to reenact the Shockmaster fall from many years ago. And Dane said, "I'm not falling." So Maverick put the helmet on, and then he ended up falling instead by accident, and Dane laughed at him. You know, for all the crap that people talk about WCW, Triple H has to be the biggest WCW fan in the world when you look at all of the WCW influence in NXT. Seriously, people talk a lot of shit about WCW. But he's got to be the biggest fan of all. And then spin the wheel, make the deal. Landed on tables, ladders, and scares for the women's title match between Io Shirai and Candice LeRae. We found out what TLS stood for. They suspended the belt above the ring, and this became a ladder match. Io got a special entrance with Poppy. Poppy was back. Poppy sang her to the ring. These ladies killed themselves, especially Candice at the finish. Candice pulled a table out from under the ring early, and there was a little bag or a sack sitting on the underbelly of the table. So she opened it, and the bag was filled with bloody body parts. Katie Vick in a bag. Triple H has had her hiding under the ring for all these years. Who knows what he's been doing with those body parts? I don't think I want to know. But Io used one of Katie's arms as a weapon to hit Candice with. Candice hit Io with Vic Joseph's laptop. That was a pretty wicked shot. Io missed a moonsault onto a pile of chairs. Candice took a suplex onto an open, unfolded steel chair, which looked like it sucked for her. Candice hit a twisting neck breaker at one point off the apron down through two tables below. So then Ghostface returns. After helping her husband out in the opener, he or she comes out to help Candice climb the ladder. Shotzi Blackheart got involved and gave Ghostface the electric chair onto a pile of chairs. And Candice, meanwhile, was on the ladder. She has the match won. All she had to do was just reach up and grab the belt, and Io tipped over the ladder. Candice took a dangerous, any bump off a ladder is dangerous, but she took a dangerous looking bump off the ladder, out of the ring. She landed hip first, thigh first on this ladder bridge that broke outside. And that was it. That was the end of Candice LeRae. Io Shirai grabs the belt and retains her championship. Top to bottom, an excellent show that deserved the ratings win that it got this week. So I give the return of Halloween Havoc an enthusiastic thumbs up. And I only wish that I could share that same enthusiasm for Monday Night Raw. Once again, we are headed into brand warfare at Survivor Series with absolutely nothing on the line. Now, we have a few weeks yet before Survivor Series, so it is possible the WWE may finally wake up this year and realize, hey, you know what? We ought to put something on the line here. There's still time for them to do that. But judging from what they do every single year, I will not hold my breath waiting. Nothing's on the line. Just bragging rights. Bragging rights for a bunch of people who, in many cases, were not even part of the brand that they are on up until 2 weeks ago. How is one to have brand loyalty for a brand that they just joined? It's just bragging rights. And that doesn't work. You know how I know that doesn't work? Because years ago, when pay-per-view was still a thing, WWE actually had a pay-per-view literally called Bragging Rights. And you know how many of those we got? I think two. Maybe one. I want to say two. Didn't last very long. Had the event done well, we would have had bragging rights every year. But we didn't. Because people didn't give a shit. They got a trophy that we never saw again. Who cares? Nobody cares about bragging rights. Last year, and by the way, no NXT involvement this year. Last year, NXT won the Battle of the Brands. I think they won something like 4 out of the 7 matches at Survivor Series. They were made to look strong all month long in November, and then at Survivor Series, NXT won. Now, the reason they won is not because Vince McMahon said, oh boy, I think NXT should win. I think NXT, we need to make sure the NXT brand looks good over our guys. No. Last year, there was a brand new wrestling show over on TNT called AEW Dynamite. And so their goal was to put over NXT as strong as possible. And I'm glad they did. I mean, it didn't really work. They still get their asses kicked on most weeks. Although, not that either show is doing gangbuster numbers, but whatever their goal was there, it didn't work. But what they did was good, because you should be putting over the younger generation. You should be putting over the NXT brand. That NXT brand is going to be the brand that carries your Raw and SmackDown shows in the years to come. So I find no fault in them putting NXT over like they did last year. I thought it was a great thing. Now, I would not at all be surprised, though, if part of the reason that they're not using NXT this year is because of all this COVID stuff. You know, they got these guys working out of the COVID Coliseum down there in Orlando, and I could see them not wanting to take any chances. We just had another scare the week before last. That's not the first time. It is perfectly sensible to think that, you know what? Maybe we shouldn't be mixing these rosters together because the people down there, I don't know that we can trust them. And I don't want them to infect our Raw or SmackDown talent. So you know what? We're going to keep NXT out of the equation this year. Maybe that's why they kept them out of the draft, too. It does make sense. Survivor Series has given us some great interbrand matches between champions the past 3 years. Almost all of which involved Brock Lesnar, who is not even on the card this year. Brock Lesnar against AJ Styles in 2017... was excellent. Brock Lesnar against Daniel Bryan in 2018 was excellent. Brock Lesnar against Rey Mysterio last year was very good. It was not as good as the other two, but it was very good. The only other match I would put in the same category that did not involve Brock Lesnar would be Ronda Rousey against Charlotte Flair from Survivor Series 2 years ago. Rousey at the time was the Raw Women's Champion. Charlotte was a member of the SmackDown brand. And that was an excellent match. And not even the match that was originally booked. That was only booked because Becky Lynch got hurt, thanks to Nia Jax. But they had an excellent match. Even with the wonky, I think it was a DQ finish. But it puts them in a tough spot because you're taking your two top champions. Every year you're doing this. You're taking your two top champions and you're matching them up non-title, one has to win and one has to lose. And that, I guess, was always the issue with Brock, is that you knew he wasn't going to lose, most likely. So one is going to be made to look weak no matter what you do. But there's nothing on the line. Even in the elimination matches, there is never anything up for grabs. There's never anything on the line. That's why doing the draft in October is stupid, when you could do it after the Survivor Series with the brand that wins the most matches, let's say, getting some top draft picks, or the number one pick in the draft. Maybe the top male and female pick. You can configure it any way you want. That would make it mean something. Or maybe the winning world champion wins Money in the Bank immunity for 1 year, if the rules were such, and I don't think they are, but if the rules were such that the Money in the Bank winner could cash in on either title and not just the brand that they're part of, and again, I don't think it works that way, but if it did, you could say, well, the winning champion, you know, or winning brand's champion, whatever, you win Money in the Bank immunity. I mean, there's any number of clever ideas that you could come up with to at least pretend like these matches mean something. Or tie it into the Royal Rumble match. We have a little bit of a gap between the Survivor Series and the Rumble. The Rumble is the next big pay-per-view coming up after this one. And the winning brand wins the 30th pick in the Rumble match, in the men's and the women's Rumble matches, even though number 30 doesn't win the Rumble very often. You could do that too. Anything. Something. But they don't do it. And then they have the gall to feed the same old bullshit line to Tom Phillips on this show. I was waiting for it. I knew it was coming. And they did not disappoint. As soon as that opening segment with Drew McIntyre was over, they cut to the announcers. And what do we hear Tom Phillips say? Survivor Series is the one night a year where Raw and SmackDown stars compete head-to-head, which is complete bullshit. Bullshit. And they tell it every year, like pull-string dolls, thinking that we're too stupid to remember all the head-to-head matches we got just in the last few months. It was actually worse this year than it usually is, with all the mixing and the head-to-head matches we got over the summer. And they have the gall to still tote that bullshit line. It's sad that because they didn't have enough sense to pick up the War Games concept, that NXT took it instead. I mean, I first pitched this 10 years ago. If you've been listening to my show since the beginning, then you guys know, because you heard me pitch the idea multiple times. When I get set on an idea, I don't shut up about it. I make it very clear what I think is the right idea and why. And that was an idea that I pitched a decade ago. That War Games, I mean, it's so perfect, right down to the name. War Games at Survivor Series. You know, once the elimination matches, which was always a staple ever since I was a kid, I was born before the Survivor Series was a thing. But once Survivor Series debuted, the whole concept was you had these elimination matches. And as a kid watching, I always was amped up for the Survivor Series, right? Because you got these teams. I remember, you know, it was Hogan and the Boss Man 1 year and Demolition. And then this other year, you know, I remember in 95, they tried something a little bit different. They did the wild card match, which meant both teams had a mix of good guys and bad guys on them. And I thought that was the coolest thing ever. It was like, oh, Gorilla Monsoon, you know, put this new concept together. But Survivor Series was truly one of the big pay-per-views of the year. It was one of the only pay-per-views of the year. But I remember when it used to be a big deal. Well, what happened is over time, because of, you know, the Monday Night War, and they started throwing out big-time matches on TV every week, and then in the 2000s, and it's only gotten worse, every week we get tag team matches. So we get six-man tags, eight-man tags. They started doing elimination matches on TV. And because we get so many tag team matches, and because there's really, I mean, nothing on the line, they've lost a lot of their luster. The Survivor Series elimination concept, it can still work if you have one really well-built elimination match. I think at Survivor Series, that's really all you need. It does not have the same appeal that it had 20 years ago or 25 years ago. It just doesn't work as well. It's just a different time. So it only made sense to think of something, okay, we got this War Games concept. Yeah, we didn't create it, but boy, you know, we could probably take ownership of it. And let's make Survivor Series mean something again. And you could still do an elimination match on the show, but let's make War Games a staple of Survivor Series. They had the opportunity to do that. They chose not to. And you could have did brand warfare in the two rings. Five Raw stars, five SmackDown stars. Put something on the line, two rings, one cage. And you would have sold a lot of pay-per-views. Instead, we have a bunch of qualifying matches on this show Monday night. That meant nothing. AJ Styles beat Jeff Hardy to advance to the Survivor Series team on Raw, the Team Raw. Hardy and Elias, by the way, are going to have a guitar on a pole match tomorrow night. Bro, we're going to do a pole match, bro. My favorite kind of match. Anything on a pole, and I can't help but think of you-know-who. Doesn't matter what you put on a pole. You put a briefcase on a pole, guitar on a pole, nightstick on a pole, pink slip on a pole. I always think of our main man, the pole man himself. Keith Lee beat Elias to join AJ Styles on Team Raw, and Sheamus beat Matt Riddle to qualify in what was easily the best match on the show. Which brings me to the news that Matt Riddle is no longer Matt Riddle. Matt Riddle will now be simply going by the name Riddle. Vince McMahon gave us back Chad Gable, but he took Matt Riddle's first name as his new hostage. I give it a few weeks. What do you think? 3 weeks? 4 weeks at the most? Before they add the letter R to the end of his name? Just go all the way with it. You know that Vince McMahon has been dying to probably do this since he first met the guy. He'll have the little eye mask on with the green suit and the question marks. His promos will consist of nothing but shitty riddles written by the creative team. Riddle me this, riddle me that. How much time is left on my contract? Now, he supposedly, if reports from a few years ago are to be believed, for people wondering how much time is left on Matt Riddle's contract, my understanding is that he had signed a 3-year deal back in 2018, which, if that's accurate, would mean that next year could be his final year. But we don't know if when he got called up to the main roster, he signed a new deal. So we don't know how much time Matt Riddle actually has left on his contract. According to Meltzer, this is his hypothesis here. I don't know that I completely buy into this, but according to him, the reason for the name change has to do not with any kind of dissatisfaction with his character or anything like that, but it has to do with not wanting people to Google his name, to Google the name Matt Riddle, and find all of the lawsuits against him and the company, all the stories about the lawsuits and the accusations. Riddle himself, later on, tweeted that he has been called Riddle most of his life, and it's okay, he doesn't mind it, he actually kind of prefers it. Which is exactly what I would expect him to say, as opposed to, hey, we don't want people Googling me and reading about the sexual assault that I have been accused of. That just doesn't have the same ring to it. I wouldn't expect Matt Riddle to come out and say that. If you have somebody on your television show who has been sued for sexual harassment or sexual assault, which is even worse, you've got bigger problems than worrying about people Googling them. I've heard of some stupid name changes, but this is among the dumbest that I have ever heard. Just because of how unnecessary it is. If you are that concerned about having somebody on your show who has been accused of sexual assault, the answer is not to take away the person's first name to try to fool people. Because you're not fooling anybody. The answer is not to take away their first name to try to fool people. If you are truly that concerned, then you take him off of television until this is all resolved. The problem is, this could go on for years. You don't know how long it's going to take to get this resolved. Who's telling the truth, what the end result is going to be. So if not, then just stop fucking with people's names for no reason. You're not fooling anybody. I don't even necessarily buy that as the real reason. Vince McMahon has done this to countless other people for years now. Why all of a sudden are we supposed to believe that they took his first name away because of all of the accusations? He has done this with countless other people for years. Chopping off their first names. Now, some people get them back. Mustafa Ali. He was very upset that they took the name away, and it was months of Ali, and then eventually he got his name back. Maybe he fought for it. Others are not so lucky. And frankly, a lot of them, you know what? You end up getting used to it in time. Alexander Rusev just became Rusev, and after a while, people didn't really think about it. Antonio Cesaro became Cesaro. After a while, people didn't think about it. That doesn't mean that it wasn't stupid. But yes, a lot of them, over time, people just kind of get used to it. Some of them might even be better without it, like Murphy. Instead of being Buddy Murphy, now he's just Murphy. I actually thought that was an improvement when they made that change. But that does not mean it is not batshit insane that he keeps doing this. The nicknames are bad enough. I'm at least glad it sounds like they've dropped the whole Bodacious Barefoot Bro. We went through that period for a few weeks. I haven't heard them mention that name in a while. Matt Riddle, he's the Bodacious Barefoot Bro. Cowabunga! Yeah, it seems like they've dropped that. Maybe when they film the Netflix documentary about him, we'll get some insight into what Vince McMahon has against First People's names. There's got to be some kind of deep-rooted issue here. Did he get picked on at school by a bully that only had one name? Riddle. The man's brain is riddled. Riddled with holes. Drew McIntyre pinned The Miz. Fresh off of The Miz's Money in the Bank win. This is something they've done countless times over the years. Person wins Money in the Bank and they just get beaten and beaten and beaten because, well, they've got the briefcase. We can beat them. Remember when Daniel Bryan won it? They did that to Daniel Bryan. They did that to, I think, Damian Sandow. They've done it to countless people over the years. So he pinned The Miz. Now, The Miz, who beat Otis, he now is the owner of the Money in the Bank briefcase. The Miz last cashed in Money in the Bank 10 years ago for the WWE title against Randy Orton on November 22nd, which just so happens to be the night of Survivor Series this year, in the same city, in the very same building that they're going to be in. They're going to be at the Thunderdome at the Amway Center on the 22nd. I mean, you could not time this any better. He has got to cash in at Survivor Series. He has to. It's too perfect for him not to. Every circumstance is exactly the same as it was 10 years ago. It's like when you hear about these rare like moon sightings or a blood moon or Halley's Comet. These things don't come along very often. I think it's too perfect for him not to cash in. He should lose. The Miz should not be winning the WWE Championship. That is laughable at this point. Not the way that he's been booked. I have no interest in seeing The Miz as the WWE champ. If you took that title off of Drew McIntyre to put it on Randy Orton just to give it to The Miz, you are a fucking moron. So when I say The Miz should cash in at Survivor Series, he should cash in and lose. That briefcase is a lost cause for this year. They had no plan for it. It is a lost cause. I consider it a lost briefcase for 2020. Otis has been dicked around so much that in the end, the babyface should get revenge. Everything was taken away from Otis. His briefcase was taken away. His tag team partner was taken away. His girlfriend was taken away. I'd like to see him get one over on The Miz when The Miz attempts to cash in at Survivor Series and Otis costs him the cash in. Because as I said, The Miz right now as WWE champion is a joke. I would not even entertain the thought of it. Comical. They gave away a Survivor Series elimination match on Raw with the Hurt Business challenging Retribution. Bobby Lashley is wrestling Sami Zayn at Survivor Series. U.S. champion against Intercontinental champion, so maybe that's why they felt they had to do it here instead of waiting. I would have held this off until Survivor Series, with the stipulation being that if the Retribution group loses, they have to disband and just end this garbage already. I'm looking for the exit ramp if I'm WWE. This group is completely, I mean, it was lost from day one. It is as apparent as ever. I don't even care if they start winning a few matches. This group is a lost cause. I'm looking for the nearest exit and a way to get out of this. And that was their way out. Retribution and the Hurt Business, they've kind of been feuding. You set up the elimination match at Survivor Series, right? Perfect place for it. Retribution says, if we lose, then Retribution is no more. And that's where you end it. That's your opening to end this once and for all. Take it out back, put a slug in the back of its head, and put it out of its misery. It would be a mercy killing. In the middle of this match, Mia Yim gets up on the apron, and she begins to convulse. Now, she went on Twitter after the show and said, it was not a seizure, I am not an epileptic. It reminds me of when Goldust started doing the Tourette's gimmick many years ago, when he got thrown into the electrical panel by Evolution. And I remember him being on Howard Stern, and Howard Stern was eating this up. Every time Goldust would start twitching and, you know, doing his thing, and Stern thought it was the funniest thing in the world, but he kept calling it Tourette's, and Goldust was being very sad. Goes, no, it's not Tourette's. He said, well, what is it? He goes, it's a neurological condition. Bullshit. When they conceived of the idea is that Goldust would be electrocuted and he would have Tourette's. Just like here. Oh, whoa, no, it's not a seizure. She says she was having, what did she say she was having? It was a possession. It was a possession. Which I guess she tried her best to play it off that way. If you watch it back, she's like scratching herself. It's almost like she had like ants on her or something. But she made it very clear, this was not a seizure. I am not an epileptic. I would never fake a medical condition like that. Fightful had reported that originally that was kind of the idea that Vince McMahon had. And there were people who were very much against it. He wanted her to have a seizure. And Mia Yim and other people involved spoke up and said, look, it would be in poor taste. And they convinced Vince McMahon to change his mind and back down. So they did what apparently all the wrestlers with their Twitch accounts were unable to do. They were unable to convince him to back down. But yeah, if it were Vince McMahon's way, she would have been on TV having a seizure on Monday night. But instead, she was having a possession. See, what I think is that Mia Yim is allergic to shitty booking. And that's why she went into spasms. No one is happier than Mercedes Martinez right now. I guarantee you that. That she narrowly avoided this whole debacle. There can be nobody happier than her. But this was all done to distract MVP, who was rolled up and pinned by Slapdick for one of the falls in this match. The referee realized that Mia Yim was putting on an act. He ejected her from the ring. Mustafa Ali ended up being the last person alone on Retribution's side. He used a chair on, I think, Cedric Alexander it was for the DQ. And then he ran away, which is Retribution pretty much in a nutshell. Team Raw on the women's side at Survivor Series is going to consist of Nia Jax, Shayna Baszler, Mandy Rose, Dana Brooke, and Lana, who won a four-way match for the spot over Peyton Royce, Lacey Evans, and Nikki Cross. And then Nia Jax promptly put Lana through a table for the sixth straight week since her husband went on TV and said naughty things about Vince McMahon. And I will end my Raw thoughts by actually saying something nice. You know, I used to have a segment here on the podcast called Say Something Nice About Impact. I may have to bring it back, but for Raw instead. Alexa Bliss, I think, has been fantastic in this new role of hers as the follower of The Fiend. She was on the Funhouse this week. She hosted a moment of bliss at the end of the show with Randy Orton. I think that she is killing it in this role, and it is the most interesting thing on the entire show. Orton knew The Fiend was near. He wouldn't let his guard down. He wouldn't sit down. He was looking around. Drew McIntyre came out The two of them fought. Alexa Bliss is sitting on top of the rope. She's on the top turnbuckle, sitting there laughing and watching them fight. And the lights went out. When they came on, Randy was in the aisle. Drew was still in the ring. But then behind Orton was the Fiend. And he knew it. He wouldn't turn around, but he knew it. And instead of turning around and being attacked by the Fiend, he opted to walk back to the ring, where Drew McIntyre was waiting, and the two of them continued to fight. The Fiend disappeared. We never saw him again after that. I don't know where he went. But Orton and McIntyre were fighting. And I believe the final scene, this did not air on USA, but it is on the YouTube clip, because I think they went off the air a little bit early. But the show actually ended with Drew McIntyre taking a pen. He had Orton laid on the announce desk. He took a pen and he tried to gouge his eyes out with the pen. And that's where the show ended. What is it with people trying to gouge other people's eyeballs out on this show? I can understand the viewers wanting to gouge out their own eyeballs given the quality of some of these shows. But the wrestlers, that I don't understand. So the match at Survivor Series is Randy Orton, the WWE Champion, against Roman Reigns as the Universal Champion. This here, if you look at the end of the show, this looked like it was building to a triple threat with Orton, McIntyre, and The Fiend. So what I would have done, I mean, this would be the year to not do champion versus champion, non-title. And instead, I would have had Orton defend against Drew and The Fiend. And have Roman Reigns maybe defend against Daniel Bryan, which they planted the seed for already on SmackDown this week. I guess now it wouldn't make much sense because Daniel Bryan lost at the end of the show. But I would have rather seen that than just doing a random match between Orton and Roman Reigns, which you know is probably not going to have a clean finish anyway. Over on SmackDown, I thought Hell in a Cell would be the end for Jey Uso. I'm happy that it is not. He continues to do great work in this story with Roman Reigns. He was beside himself on this show, standing next to Roman. Roman was playing it cool. He was all laid back. And he just could not bring himself. Jey could not bring himself to say the words and fall in line. He started crying. Why are you doing me like this? Roman says, fall in line or you're out. You're out of the family. And he gave him until the end of the night to do so. And I think the one misstep that they made on Friday was not having more segments, even just one more segment in the middle of the show, in the back, showing the struggle that Jey was having, or maybe he was having a conversation with his brothers, or something, just to illustrate this internal struggle that he was having with bringing himself to do what he ended up doing at the end of the night. Kevin Owens earned a spot on Team SmackDown with a win over Dolph Ziggler. Bianca Belair earned a spot on Team SmackDown for the ladies with a win over Billie Kay and Natalya. That was the right call. That was the only call to make, given the people in that match. Corey Graves sat down with Lars Sullivan. I expect Vince McMahon to do the opposite of what he did with Matt Riddle and eventually chop off Lars's last name. I'm kind of surprised he hasn't already done it. But soon he will just be Lars. This was their attempt to fill in some backstory for him. It kind of felt like they were trying to do with Lars what they did with Mankind when he had his sit-down interview with Jim Ross back in 1997. That was a multi-part interview. I did a feature a few years ago on what I thought are the top 9 promos in WWE history. It might have been was it 9? I'm trying to think. Maybe it was like the 9-year anniversary of the show or something. But I did a top 9, and that was the one that I put in the number 1 spot as the greatest promo or interview, series of interviews in WWE history. What was that Mankind interview? This was decidedly not that. Not even close. But he told a story here about being mocked on the playground at school and being called a freak and how he cried. But the crying stopped about 20 minutes later and it was replaced by the screams of the other kids who were mocking him and making fun of him. And after that, he was no longer allowed at school. And he says he wants to make WWE his own personal playground. Very generic stuff here, but I do like that they're at least trying to give him a story. You know, when he was on NXT, and this is probably now, I'm going to say this is probably going back, I don't know, 3 years maybe. And he was still being called, he was still going by his name. He was still being called Dylan Miley. I think it was later that year they gave him the Lars Sullivan name. But he was doing this split personality type gimmick with him. Or maybe it was just that he had a temper that he couldn't control. And when he lost his temper, it like blinded him with rage and he had no memory of what he had done. It was one of those types of gimmicks. And so they would pair him up in a tag team match with a random enhancement guy and they would lose. And he would blame the loss on the other guy. The other guy would usually take the fall. And he would snap after the match and he would beat them up. But then in the back, they would have a segment later with the jobber he was being tended to in the trainer's room. And in would come Miley and he was all apologetic. Oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean it. I lost my cool. Are you going to be okay? You know, it was like Jekyll and Hyde. And that was the character they were doing with him for a while. And then they just dropped it. That could have been a more interesting way to go with him. I mean, I don't know. It's like the Hulk, right? You make the Hulk mad and you kind of set him off. But at least they're trying to add another layer to him. You know, he's getting a push. And so if he's going to be on TV and you want to try to make the character interesting, maybe this isn't the way. I mean, this story wasn't exactly compelling. This was pretty paint-by-number stuff. But at least they're trying to add another layer to his character. The Days of Our Lives telenovela continues with Seth Rollins and Murphy and the Mysterio family. Murphy called out Ray and Dominic so he could apologize to them for all the things that he had done, all of his past transgressions, and let them know, I'm sorry, I'm not the same person I was before. When I tried to blind you, you know, just that little minor thing when I helped Seth Rollins try to blind you and gouge your eye out. Aaliyah is now with Murphy. She came to the ring with him. Seth Rollins came out to said that he accepts their relationship. Dominic attacked Rollins. Murphy attacked Rollins. Dominic attacked Murphy. Try to keep up now. Ray came out. This all ended with Ray going for a 619 on Murphy. And his daughter stepped in the way. Aaliyah stepped in the way right before Ray could hit the move. No, Dad, leave him alone. He says, you're coming with me. Like he's fucking RoboCop. You're coming with me. And she says, no, I'm not going with you. I love him, she says. She loves Murphy. Uh-oh. There's the L word. Run, Murphy, run! Actually, it's funny. His name is Murphy. I just made a Robo... I swear to God, I didn't plan that. I made a RoboCop reference, and the other guy's name is Murphy. How eerie is that? See, it's even more appropriate now. But she says she loves him. She loves Murphy. And then Aaliyah plants a wet one right on his lips. Murphy and Aaliyah share a kiss right in front of her father and her brother, and they just don't even know what to think about this. Ay, Dios mío. I mean, this is just crazy what we're seeing here. You know, I guess it's cool for Rey Mysterio to be able to work with his family. Maybe he looks at it as, you know what? Not that he wants his daughter to be sucked up into this love storyline or anything, but he probably looks at it and goes, you know what? I'm getting my kids exposure on TV. I get to come to work every week with my wife and with my son and with my daughter. And maybe he just thinks it's the coolest thing in the world that he gets to travel and work with his family every week. Maybe that's how he looks at this whole situation. And Fox, you know, this is probably the kind of stuff that they love. Got to have the soap opera drama on the show, and I guess this kind of fits the bill. Still have no idea where this is going. I really am drawing a blank here. Because, you know, at this point, if we come to find out Murphy and Rollins are in cahoots, and it's all just a hoax, and they're just trying to, get, you know, drive a wedge in the Mysterio family, it is possible. That is very possible that Murphy and Rollins, you know, Murphy is still a disciple of Rollins, And they just agreed, look, if we're going to do this, we got to do it right. We got to be convincing. They had a match a few weeks ago where Rollins beat him. But maybe the end result here is just to get back at the Mysterio family, just to get back at Rey Mysterio. And their plan is working. Rey's daughter has fallen in love with Murphy, although they would have had no way of predicting that. You know, if you think about this in a storyline sense. Outside of that, I just don't know what the end result of this is. Bayley gets her rematch for the SmackDown Women's Championship with Sasha Banks next week. So coming up this Friday. She did indeed mention the fact that Sasha can win titles, but she just can't hold on to them. And whoever the champion is will meet Asuka, because it's got to be the Raw champion against the SmackDown champion at Survivor Series. So it's going to be either Asuka against Sasha Banks or Asuka against Bayley. And because they abused it so much over the summer, neither of those potential matches feel special at all. Because we've already seen Asuka against Sasha. We've already seen Asuka against Bayley. Multiple times. Asuka and Sasha would probably have a pretty kick-ass match. But we've already seen it. They already blew it over the summer. And Jey Uso pinned Daniel Bryan clean in the main event to earn a spot on Team SmackDown at Survivor Series. Daniel Bryan, who has talked openly recently about this being the last run of his career, retirement is in the not-too-distant future for him. Supposedly, he's taking a more active role behind the scenes creatively. You know, he was the one behind the Big E. Big E credited Daniel Bryan with being the one who pushed him to get a singles push. And Bryan's been behind Jey Uso as well. And I think Daniel Bryan could be a very, depending on how much influence he really has, seemingly he has some. SmackDown, I think, objectively has been a better show than Raw now for a number of weeks. And if Bryan has anything to do with that, then I think his real future may be better off behind the scenes. Because I think at this point, you know, and I say that as a Daniel Bryan fan, and I was a big fan of his run before. You can't really replicate that story. You certainly can't replicate that story in a building with virtual fans. So what do you really expect to do on TV, I guess, with Daniel Bryan? Roman Reigns is killing it right now as the Universal Champion. I don't think that giving Daniel Bryan the title is something that even he necessarily would want. I think the role for Bryan now is probably working with some of these guys and helping to put them over. Now, I do think that it's a natural match to do Bryan against Roman Reigns. You can play off their history. You can play off everything that happened going back to 2015 and the fans turning on Roman. They wanted Daniel Bryan. So there's definitely a story there already built in that you can play off of. I would not expect Bryan to win, but absolutely, they should be doing that match sometime in the next few months. But I think the last of Bryan's really big runs, it's behind him. It's not about crowning Daniel Bryan as Universal Champion anymore. It's about Roman Reigns doing his thing, but it's about guys like a Jey Uso. I don't think Jey Uso is going any higher. Jey Uso is not going to be a permanent member of the main event scene. I think he's been doing great work. I think he's in a great spot. If he's aligned with Roman, he's going to be in a good spot for a while. Jey Uso is not a main eventer. I just answered an email from somebody about this yesterday. Do you think that Jey Uso, with the right push, could continue to be a main eventer? No, I don't. Jey Uso is not a main eventer. And that's not even really a knock on Jey Uso. I've said similar things before when people have asked me about WWE dropping the ball on Zack Ryder and could Zack Ryder have been a world champion? No. No. And I think people have to understand something here, which is that over the years, a lot of people have become world champion or WWE champion, who would never have been the champion 20 or 30 years ago. And in some cases, that's a good thing because it means that people have evolved their view of pro wrestling and who could be a world champion. That could be a good thing, but also it's not always necessarily a good thing because it just doesn't feel as special when you become the world champion if everybody else is becoming the world champion, right? So it kind of goes both ways. Some people are just not meant to be a world champion, top flight main event player. Not because they can't work. There's plenty of great wrestlers who aren't necessarily world champion material or the kind of person that you would want to build a brand around. There will never be a brand built around a Jey Uso. There was never going to be a brand built around a Zack Ryder, and that might be a tough pill for some people to swallow. And I'm not trying to slight them. I'm just being honest. Some people are not meant to be in that position. They don't have all of the tools that are meant to be in a fixed position in the main event. I don't see Jey Uso being one of those people. I enjoy the run that he's having now, but it's a temporary thing. But a guy, you know, there are other people on the roster, whether it's, you know, it could be a Big E. It could be a Big E, or it could be somebody who's in NXT who we're not even thinking about right now, who can be that next big breakout main event level performer. But this was never going to be a permanent, I mean, we knew it wasn't going to be permanent anyway, because when his brother was recovered, they were going to put the Usos back together. But no, Jey Uso is not going to be a permanent main eventer. But what Daniel Bryan is doing is he's helping to give Jey Uso credibility. Jey Uso got a clean win in the ring over Daniel Bryan. That gives him credibility. That gives people a reason, even though he didn't beat Roman Reigns, he lost twice to Roman Reigns. He couldn't close the deal. It gives people at least a reason when they see him on TV to think, you know what? This guy, he still belongs for now. Because he beat AJ Styles clean. And he beat Daniel Bryan clean. And that's the best way to help get somebody over. You have credible top guys who are putting over these other people. That's the best way to do it. So I liked what they did here. I liked the fact that Jey got the win. He's still going to be involved in this, you know, for a little while longer. I thought Jey would lose. And that loss would be the final nail that kind of sent him over the edge. And then he would turn heel on Bryan in like a fit of rage and align with Roman Reigns. Instead, they had him win clean. Bryan now has no spot for the time being on the Survivor Series card. Had they not done this match, I would have preferred Bryan earning the next shot at Roman's title and doing that match at Survivor Series instead. Or at least the first and maybe a two-match program between Bryan and Reigns. Roman came out. He wanted his answer when the match was over. And Jey Uso just said, "I'm with you. I'm with you. You're the head of the table." Just like that. That's where I think another couple of segments of like introspection on the show could have helped, because after refusing to say that in the opening segment, he was more than willing to say it at the end of the match. And it's like, wow, okay, well, I guess we're supposed to just assume that in those 2 hours, even though we couldn't see it, he was in the back just kind of wrestling with himself and reconciling, and he realized that, you know what, I've got to do it. You know, I've got no choice. I lost the match. He's got me dead to rights. And I have to do it. And you would have to think that Jimmy Uso, once he is physically cleared and ready to come back, he'll be part of that group as well. Now, it's 5 years later than I originally pitched it, but we're getting it now. We're getting this Samoan bloodline group, Samoan Dynasty. Actually, the bloodline might not be such a bad name for it, but whatever they call it, we're getting this group now on SmackDown. I didn't think Roman needed it. I don't think he does need it. But you know what? It keeps Jey Uso in the mix, and that's a great thing. Without his brother, were it not for the Roman Reigns storyline, Jey Uso would not even be on TV. He would be sitting in catering in the back. He has earned this spot. And this storyline continues to be the best thing on WWE television. Now, a lot of people were missing from this show. There was no Otis coming off the screw job by Tucker at Hell in a Cell. Tucker's not even on the same brand, so good luck trying to figure that out. I mean, I would think the plan is for each of them to earn a spot on their respective brand team at Survivor Series, so Otis and Tucker would be on opposing sides. But that would be the sensible thing to do. Doesn't always explain why they do the things they do. And no follow-up to last week with Chad Gable. He needs to be on the show this Friday to follow up from his promo last week. I know he's not priority numero uno for Vince McMahon, but you did take the time to have the guy cut a promo and change his name back, so it would be nice to get him back on the show. Hopefully that'll happen this week. Now, some AEW notes. According to PW Insider, Abaddon is doing okay after receiving a hard strike to the throat in the match that was being taped for Dynamite this past week, which did not air, between her and Tay Conti. Because the match had to be stopped and Abaddon was taken to the hospital, they just junked the whole match. They say she's okay. We don't have any kind of official update. I mean, I know she's tweeting, so she's obviously... she's not unconscious or something horrible like that. She's obviously doing okay. Don't know when she'll be back in the ring, though. I mean, she wasn't really appearing on Dynamite anyway, and now there's no telling when we may see her again on TV. So instead, we got Serena Deeb against Layla Hirsch. The Dynamite debut of legit Layla Hirsch in a match for the NWA Women's Championship that Serena had just won from Thunder Rosa 24 hours earlier on the Primetime Live, UWN Primetime Live pay-per-view. A lot of NWA stars have been wrestling of late on those UWN shows since the NWA is still not running shows of their own. They have essentially partnered up with the NWA. Dave Marquez, who did the ring announcing and some interviews for the NWA, is the man behind the UWN operation, so that makes sense. I thought Layla Hirsch looked very impressive in her match in defeat against Serena Deeb. She comes from an amateur wrestling background, and she toured Stardom earlier this year. She was a member of the Tokyo Cyber Squad. With Thunder Rosa losing her NWA women's title, that has led to a lot of speculation about her future. Dave Meltzer says that she has a lot of interest from WWE, a lot of interest from AEW, but Billy Corgan put a statement out on his Instagram account batting down any reports of her signing with another promotion, making it very clear that Rosa is not going anywhere. He has her under contract. The NWA has her under contract through 2021. I don't know if that means through the entire year or the summer. I mean, he didn't say. He just said through 2021, Thunder Rosa is under contract. It doesn't look like he's interested in letting her out of that contract like they were so willing to do with James Storm when he got interest from WWE. So that's the update on Thunder Rosa. That at least we have clarification from Corgan himself that she ain't going nowhere. What I hope that means is that soon the NWA is going to start running shows of their own, because if she's locked in a contract for another year and they're not going to run any shows, I mean, I would hope that means at least we'll be seeing more of Rosa on AEW television. I mean, her stock has never been higher than it is right now. She needs to be on TV. Now, it does sound like she's going to be doing more MMA fights. So maybe they planned that title change knowing that she might have to step away to do some training for some upcoming fights. I think she's got two fights, I believe, left on her deal with the Combates Americas promotion. Let me just say this about WWE having a possible interest in her, because I think it stemmed from something Meltzer flat out said, and now he may be backtracking a little bit, but that's really where these reports came from. You know, that it looks like WWE maybe signed her, or she's going to sign with them, but let me, and that does not look like that is actually going to happen, but let me just address that. It is not that I don't think that NXT, she wouldn't have some great ladies to work with in NXT. I do. NXT's women's division right now, as I said before, is as good and as robust as the women's division anywhere else in this country right now. So she would have a lot of names to work with if she went to NXT. Thunder Rosa against Io Shirai, Ember Moon, Rhea Ripley, Candice LeRae, Toni Storm. I mean, I would love to see those matches. But anyone going to the main roster, if Vince McMahon does not believe in them, it is always a huge question mark. And that is what scares me. So when I make those comments about, oh my God, I hope she doesn't go here, or oh my God, if she goes here, that's the end. We've seen enough examples of this to, I think, be scared. I mean, if you are a fan of somebody and you want to see them succeed and do well, and they got over being a certain personality here, but then they come here and then they make them change, or they're not getting any time on TV, or they're being downplayed. I mean, I've seen this countless times before. These guys or these women, they have a lot of interest. They have a lot of buzz around them. And then it's just, you know, dead in its tracks. And I don't want to see that happen to Thunder Rosa. She's a good talent. Miro was a guest on the Inside the Ropes podcast, and he was asked for his thoughts on the reaction that some fans had to his Dynamite debut, going on TV and doing the best man gimmick with Kip Sabian. And a lot of fans thought that he should be doing something a bit more high profile. This was his response. As it relates to those, well, I say fans, apparently that's not how he views them. This is what Miro had to say. I don't care what you think about my gimmick. I don't care about any of these things because, quite honestly, I don't care. Okay, well, he's made that very clear. I am the best man. You've got to understand that I have been pushed down for way too long, that all of a sudden, for me to start listening to fans, or to not even fans, because these are not fans, these are just critics. Because fans just enjoy what you give to them. Critics are completely different. So let me stop there. I guess after being in WWE and being in that WWE bubble for so long, I mean, Miro was there for a long time. If you count his time in NXT, right, developmental, he probably spent the better part of 5 or 6 years working for WWE. And I guess after being there for so long, it is kind of understandable that the man would still be brainwashed. That last sentence is WWE. I mean, it encapsulates WWE and the attitude there perfectly. Fans should just enjoy what you give to them. Well, Miro, as somebody who has been a fan for almost as long as the number of years that you have been alive on this earth, who happens to also have a podcast where, yes, I do offer opinions and critiques. You are full of shit. And I take offense to the notion that because we're all fans, that we should just like and accept what is given to us. You are full of shit. Now, in the next breath, he makes a statement that actually, I think, has a lot of validity. He says, I think what we have done, and it's not just the fault of wrestling, but just as a society, we want the quick turnaround right away. Right then and there. We don't like waiting for episodes to come week to week. We don't want to wait the 30 minutes. But if I had come to AEW and become champion on day one, there was going to be 90 other million people who were going to be like, oh, well, look at this. He's just another former WWE guy coming in and taking the title. And look, we have Hangman Page and the Bucks and everybody else is just waiting for their opportunity. That is true. Although I don't personally know anybody who is saying that Miro should come in on day one and win the AEW title. But we'll set that aside for a second. But it is true, the viewer's attention span has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller over the years. And that's not just a wrestling thing, although it does affect wrestling a lot. And you would have had some fans who would have complained about another ex-WWE guy coming in and leapfrogging all of the AEW originals for a top spot. But if somebody has an opinion that Miro doing what he's doing right now is not maximizing the potential that he has, I think that's a perfectly valid opinion to have. Maybe 6 months from now, the best man is going to be doing something else. Maybe he'll be challenging for a title. Maybe he'll be working with Jungle Boy or Darby Allin or Cody or somebody higher up in the pecking order. But whenever I hear that a wrestler make a comment like that, that you're not a real fan if you criticize, a real fan would basically just keep their mouth shut and just take what's given to them and like it. Smile and say thank you. May I have another? All that does is reinforce the idea that for as much as people want to call the fans marks, and a lot of wrestlers do, there are wrestlers who see it as a derogatory term, who do actually like the fans, who will not insult the fans by using it. But yes, plenty of people inside the wrestling business, they call the fans marks. They have done it for decades. All the people who want to call the wrestling fans marks, the biggest marks of all, are the wrestlers themselves. And this is just another example of that. Now on Dynamite this Wednesday, Pac is back. He is being billed for an interview. I don't think he'll be there in person, but he is being billed for an interview where he will break his silence. This will be the first time on AEW television for Pac since the pandemic shows began. I hope that means that they have a sense that he may be able to travel soon and get back in the ring. Frankly, I don't know why he wouldn't be able to, unless he just has chosen not to, which I totally understand. But, you know, Pete Dunne, we just saw him on NXT UK, and then boom, Pete Dunne was down in Orlando, you know, back on NXT this week. So I don't think it's a case where he can't travel. I hope that it's a sign that we'll be seeing him back in the ring soon. Hangman and Omega are going to the finals of the Eliminator at Full Gear. They did both advance to the finals. They will meet to determine a number one contender for the AEW World title. Things are set up perfectly in that story. I see it where Omega, I think he will win. I think he should win. I think he probably cheats to win. He'll try everything he can against Hangman, thinking that it's going to be maybe not an easy win, but he's going to find that it's a lot harder than he expected. And he may have to take a shortcut to get to the win. But I think Kenny Omega is the one who will go on and be the man to take that belt away from Jon Moxley. Maybe at the Revolution pay-per-view in February. It could still be a few months. But I think he should be the one. I think he will be the one. And the longer-term story is building to Hangman Page eventually being the one to dethrone Kenny Omega. And now we have a hell of a match lined up for Full Gear, which is coming up actually next weekend. Less than a week, next Saturday night, is the AEW pay-per-view, and I will be here with you live. I will be on YouTube as soon as the pay-per-view goes off the air. So you're going to have a big weekend next week. You get an AEW pay-per-view recap on Saturday night, and then I'll get maybe 3 hours of sleep if I'm lucky. And the next morning, we'll have episode 677. So it's going to be a fun weekend.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, 30 years ago this week, on October 30th, 1990, at what was supposed to be a Saturday night's main event taping to air on NBC 1 month later, Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty, the Rockers, beat the Hart Foundation in a 2 out of 3 falls match to win the WWF Tag Team titles, a reign that is not officially recognized, and a match that ended up never airing on TV. Only years later, it came out on DVD. WWE gave the belt back to the Hart Foundation and acted like the title change never happened. One reason being that the top rope broke during the match and Vince McMahon decided that he just couldn't air the match. Now, having watched the match myself, because I've seen it a couple of times over the years, they could have edited that part out if they wanted to. There was definitely a way to edit that out. But it definitely affected the rest of the match. I mean, in his book, Bret Hart said the same thing. He blamed the referee. They were both pissed. He and Anvil, if you watch that match, they are pissed. I mean, at one point, you could even hear Anvil in the background. He's cursing up a storm, even though I think he's the one who actually broke the rope. But they were not happy. They were not happy with the referee because Bret says that had the referee stopped the match once the rope broke or became loose, had he stopped the match to allow people to come in to fix the issue, it would have been fine. And he did try to explain that to the referee during the match, and it just kind of went in one ear and out the other. He said both teams, they needed that top rope. They needed the rope to do a lot of the planned spots that they had talked about before the match, and it just completely screwed everything up. I remember there was a crisscross spot during that match with Bret Hart and Marty Jannetty that actually looked like Bret screwed that up. I don't even know that that had anything to do with the top rope necessarily, but that got botched. The finish of the match looked botched as well, did not look good. There's a few other factors that played into this too. I mean, it goes beyond just the rope. NBC ended up canceling the planned Saturday night's main event special. I don't know why. I don't know if there was some other event that night that they were going to be airing. But what they did do was they gave WWE a 1 hour event. So on occasion, they would have these main event specials. It wouldn't be Saturday night's main event. It would just be called the main event. So they instead gave them a 1 hour version of the main event the night before. So the Friday night before what would have been the Saturday night's main event special, they decided to give him a 1 hour special the night before, which also just so happened to fall the night after the Survivor Series. And because the tag match ran over half an hour, I think it was like a 30 minute or 35 minute match with entrances, maybe it was closer to 40 minutes. Because of that, because they had 30 minutes chopped off what they originally thought they had, they just made the decision that, look, we can't air this. You know, we can't air this match, at least not in its entirety. And then there's also this little fact that I don't think can be overlooked in the story. Vince McMahon had decided to push Bret Hart as a singles star. He had always told him that the goal here would be, Bret, you're going to have a singles run. They put him at first with the Anvil because they wanted Bret to develop more of a personality. But the idea was that eventually, when the Hart Foundation ran its course, Bret would get the big push as a singles star. And so in 90, Vince McMahon had told Bret, it's time. We got plans to give you a singles push. They were no longer going to use the Anvil as a wrestler. He was going to try to transition Neidhart into maybe an announcer's role, and, you know, he would get some of the benefits that the employees got and the agents got working, but he would not be an active part of the roster. And I think Survivor Series was actually going to be his final night. So hence, they planned to change the titles. But then a few days later, they decided to keep Anvil as a wrestler. And Bret said that he never thought he would be so disappointed to find out that he was keeping a belt. Because he had already, you know, he knew they were dropping the tag belts. And he's like, all right, this is my big moment. I'm going to get my big singles run. Only to have it taken away from him and told, yeah, we're going to put the belts back on you. And he found that to be incredibly deflating. He was very disappointed when he found out. So all of those things together resulted in this phantom title change that never was, except for the fact that the Rockers did have one title defense. They did defend the title a few days after they won them at a house show against Power and Glory. 27 years ago this week, on October 27th, 1993, at the end of the very first night of a WCW European tour in the UK, everybody was exhausted. They had just flown about 8 or 9 hours over, I think, from the States. Then they had a few more hours to travel by bus. Then they wrestled. Then they had more travel before they finally all landed back at the hotel. So keep that in mind. Sid Vicious was at the hotel bar, as was Arn Anderson. And Sid made a comment about what he felt was wrong with the company at the time, why they weren't drawing. Said it was because of old guys like Ric Flair who couldn't just step aside. Arn's version of the story is that Sid was bragging about holding up WCW for $100,000. $100,000 a year is what he wanted as far as a raise. So he was bragging, I held him up for $100,000 a year raise, and that all these old fuckers need to retire. Meanwhile, Arn had taken a $100,000 pay cut the year before under Bill Watts. So whatever it was that was exactly said at the bar that night, the two of them had words, and depending on which version you believe, either Arn threw a beer first at Sid's face, or Sid threw a beer at Arn's face, Too Cold Scorpio was there. And Too Cold Scorpio tells the story great. So if you could ever find a shoot interview or a clip of him telling this story, definitely go back and watch it. Everybody was sent back to their rooms. And he went to go back to his room too. Too Cold Scorpio went to go back to his room. He was going to go smoke some hash. Have a nice relaxing night. All of a sudden he hears a commotion from outside. Now he figures it's Vader because I guess Vader maybe had a reputation for, I don't know, fights or getting into arguments. But he goes down the hall to where Vader's room was and he listens by the door and he hears Vader snoring. So Vader is fast asleep, so he knows that it's not Vader. So he goes downstairs, because all of this commotion is happening one level below where his room was. So he goes downstairs, and he finds the hallway covered in blood, just drenched in blood. Like something out of a horror movie. And he finds Sid standing over Arn Anderson. They're both covered in blood, And Sid has a pair of safety scissors in his hand. And Scorpio, he gets between them. He separates them. Sid then looks down and he sees a hole in his stomach. And blood is squirting out of this hole. So he stumbles down the hallway. Now, by this point, Vader had already been awoken by all of the noise. Vader comes downstairs. He comes out of his room. He is wearing nothing but his underwear. So you got to picture this in your head, or maybe you don't want to. But Vader comes out of his room. He's wearing nothing but his underwear. He comes downstairs. What the hell's going on here? And he finds Sid with blood squirting out of his stomach and probably blood all over him is, you know, coming towards him. So Vader does the only thing that he thinks he could do. He sticks his thumb in the hole in Sid's stomach to try to stop the bleeding. Scorpio is pissed because these guys were fighting. The part of the hallway where they were fighting was right outside where the rooms were that Ric Flair had and Ricky Steamboat had. And he's like, you know, these guys are friendly with these two, or, you know, Flair is obviously friendly with Arn. And he's, you know, basically these fuckers are in their room the whole time. They never came out. He had to come downstairs to try to break things up. Flair never came out of his room. Steamboat never came out of his room. Nobody else came out. So Scorpio was pissed that he had to be the one to do it. And so basically, Too Cold Scorpio and Vader, with his quick thinking, may have saved these guys' lives. It sounds like Vader definitely may have saved Sid's life. I mean, that goes without saying. And Sid, I think, tells a very similar version of the story as far as Vader's involvement. Neither man pressed charges on the other. Police didn't charge either man since I guess they were leaving the country anyway, or they may have deported them. They got out of there. The fallout is that Arn suffered 20 stab wounds all over his body. Sid got stabbed 4 times. I think he needed surgery. Sid was supposed to beat Vader for the world title at Starrcade that year, but he ended up getting fired over it because some of the boys threatened to quit if they didn't let Sid go. Ric Flair got the title instead in what turned out to be a classic match, very stiff match too. Flair had some of his teeth knocked out during that Starrcade match with Vader. Sid and Arn, they did make up many years later. They're no troubles, you know, the past is in the past. They had no troubles working for WCW at the same time. Still to this day, one of the craziest brawls in wrestling history, the scissors story between Sid and Arn Anderson. Now that makes two infamous stories involving Sid in a 2-year period. Let us not forget the squeegee incident, which came 2 years before this, and then, of course, the scissors incident. The squeegee deal was also the product of Sid running his mouth in a bar. I think we have a common denominator here now. Although he was working for WWE at that time. He had already left WCW. He was working for Vince McMahon. I guess they happened to be running the same town or the same city, I guess, maybe at the same time. And so some of the wrestlers from both companies maybe were in the bar. And they got tired. The WCW guys got tired of hearing Sid talk about how much better it was working for WWE. And Brian Pillman was ready to throw down. Brian Pillman was in the bar that night. This would have been in, I guess, 90... When did Sid come in? Sid came in 91. So this would have been in 91. And Pillman is just like, all right, enough of this shit. You know, he's ready to throw down. He's not going to back down from a fight. And he doesn't like Sid to begin with. He already had heat with Sid from earlier that year when Sid was working in WCW. He almost killed Pillman on a powerbomb, a botched powerbomb attempt in a War Games match. So Sid leaves the bar. Instead of confronting Pillman, he decides to leave. He leaves the bar, and they figure, okay, that's it. That's the end of it. We got rid of him, right? He leaves the bar, but he comes back a few minutes later, and in his hand is a squeegee. This would have been around the time that Sid was hurt. He had tore his bicep. And in fact, I think I just talked about this in the history segment last week. He was going to go on to feud with Jake the Snake Roberts, but he got hurt. That's why they slotted the Macho Man in that spot, because Sid tore his bicep. So I think this was right around the time that this happened. And he felt like, I'm hurt, right? I can't fight. I got this bum arm. So I have to go get a squeegee. I have to even the playing field here with Brian Pillman and go get a squeegee. Mike Graham was there. He supposedly yanked the squeegee right out of Sid's hand. Sid didn't do shit with it. Mike Graham yanked it out of his hand and told him that he was going to shove it up his ass if he didn't leave. And that was that. I never get tired of one of these fight or near fight stories. But those are two of the more infamous ones involving Sid. 25 years ago this week, on October 29th, 1995, WCW Halloween Havoc came to the Joe in Detroit with a battle of the monster trucks on the roof of nearby Cobo Hall between Hulk Hogan and the Giant. Hogan won after he knocked the Giant's Dungeon of Doom monster truck outside the circle as per the rules. Both men got out of their trucks, fisticuffs ensued. Hogan knocked the Giant off the roof, presumably to his death. But later in the show, the Giant looked perfectly fine, walking to the ring for his WCW World title match with Hogan. Jimmy Hart turned on Hogan in this match. He hit the ref with the title. That caused the disqualification. We would find out the next night on Nitro that Jimmy Hart, who was Hogan's manager at the time, had a secret provision inserted into the contract before the match that stated the title could change hands on a DQ. So Hogan lost the belt. The Giant became WCW champion, even though we didn't find out about it until 24 hours later. But this was the infamous night where we got the debut of the Yeti. Tony Schiavone talking about the Yeti. Came down to the ring, Ron Reese wrapped in toilet paper, or whatever the hell he was wrapped in. He and the Giant got themselves a Hogan sandwich. They were humping him, dry humping him. It's still a memory I try not to think about. One of the more ridiculous things that you'll ever see. It's 25 years ago. 23 years ago, on October 26, 1997, WCW presented Halloween Havoc, featuring one of the greatest matches in WCW history for the Cruiserweight Championship between Rey Mysterio Jr. and Eddie Guerrero. Another in a very long line of good matches between Diamond Dallas Page and the Macho Man Randy Savage. DDP, I don't think, gets enough attention as being one of Savage's all-time great opponents. I think when people think of all-time great Macho Man opponents, they think of the Ultimate Warrior. They might think of Hogan, Ric Flair. DDP belongs in that conversation. And really, I think it was the last great match that Randy Savage ever had in his career, was on this show against DDP. And you can listen to DDP speak about what that man meant to him and what that man meant to his career. To listen to him tell those Randy Savage stories and talk about him is just really cool. You can go back and listen to Sound Off episode 416 when I had DDP on to talk about his Halloween Havoc match with Bill Goldberg. And he ended up lapsing into some really cool Randy Savage stories. But, unfortunately, this show is also remembered for the Age in a Cage main event between Hulk Hogan and Rowdy Roddy Piper, an absolutely horrendous match that took place in the tallest, most cheaply designed steel cage that I have ever seen. I mean, steel cage, what am I saying? That was no steel cage. I don't know what that was, like a rubber cage. It looked like it was made out of whatever that Punjabi prison was made out of. And poor Randy Savage. He was in a very good match with DDP, right, that same night, right before this. And he interferes in this match. Comes back out for the main event, interferes in this match, and he ends up shaving years off the end of his career. When, in one of the dumbest decisions that he has ever made, he had balls. I'll give him that. The Macho Man, he was a crazy man. He had balls. He had macho balls. But Savage, who at that point was 44 years old and had a lot of mileage on that body and a lot of mileage on those knees, he decided that he was going to climb to the top of this cage. And this thing was high. Okay, did I mention that already? This was a high cage. He was at least, 20 feet at least. Maybe more, maybe 22 feet. He was high up there. I mean, he wasn't RVD or Matt Riddle high, but he was high. Hogan down below has Piper's arms hooked behind him, And he's waiting, right, for Savage to position himself. When Savage, now Savage is going to come off with a double axe handle. If you go back and watch, when Savage jumps off, you can literally see the top of the cage where he jumps off from bend. It bent. A cage should not bend like that. A cage should not bend at all. And what's worse is that Savage missed the axe handle. Hogan was positioned too far away. So instead, we got the most dangerous eye rake ever executed. But Savage completely wrecked his knees on the landing. And he was never the same after that. He did wrestle for several more months with the bad knees. But by the summer, he had to get them both operated on. And when he came back, he was massive. I mean, he was gigantic. Randy Savage, Scott Steiner. I don't know why these guys did this to themselves. Steiner, I guess, I mean, his physique is what helped him kind of cement, I guess, his place in the main event. But, I mean, he and Savage both, it ruined whatever mobility and agility they had before. And it's not like Steiner, for example, was already a big guy. Very muscular, he looked great. But, I mean, whatever he and Savage were doing and taking and pumping into themselves, I mean, my God. They were massive. And it impacted their ability to perform. But this match was so bad. It's the match that inspired Jim Cornette's classic rant on Monday Night Raw, where he ripped on the match and he ended with the line, "Hulk Hogan, you are a household word, but so is garbage, and it stinks when it gets old too." 11 years ago this week, on October 27th, 2009, in a press conference from Madison Square Garden that had been billed publicly as a promotion for his latest book, Hulk Hogan also announced that he was joining TNA Wrestling. This is when Dixie Carter made her famous comment referring to Hogan as the rocket fuel, the little bit of rocket fuel that TNA needed to take them to that next level. 11 years later, and we're all still waiting for that rocket to take off. Hogan got out of that company. He got out of that company exactly what he wanted. He got a payday. Rarely, if ever, did he promote TNA after he actually signed with them. So Hogan was always doing interviews and media stuff. Rarely, if ever, did he take the time to promote or also promote TNA. See, his strength would have been as a brand ambassador. That really is where his strength would have been. I mean, he could have been an on-air authority figure who showed up every now and then. The thing with Hogan, though, is that, you know, week after week after week, if you put him on TV every week, it's the law of diminishing returns, right? And at that point, he couldn't do what he could do even 10 years earlier, physically. But Hogan had no business being on the show every single week. So his role should have been the babyface on-air authority figure who would show up, you know, when it was appropriate to show up or show up on the big shows. But he would be a brand ambassador publicly. You know, for TNA. And getting out there and just mentioning the company every chance that he could. That's what they should have been paying him for, but that didn't happen. And the final image of Hogan in TNA was Dixie Carter latched onto his leg, begging him not to leave. He was like a dog. He was dragging her down the aisle trying to leave, and she wouldn't let go of his leg. A rather appropriate parting image. Outside of that initial curiosity, you know, rating spike that they got early on, he did nothing for the company. Hogan did nothing. Impact came out of the Hogan era weaker than they were going into it. 9 years ago, on October 26, 2011, in a match taped to air on TNA Impact the following week, Bobby Roode defeated his best friend and beer money tag team partner James Storm to win his first Impact World Championship. Still one of the better heel turns that I've ever seen. Both men were babyfaces. Roode had failed to take the title from Kurt Angle a few weeks earlier, Bound for Glory. And then the week before this match here, James Storm beat Kurt Angle on Impact in a two-minute match, which led to Storm giving Roode a championship match. And this turn, it was so well done. Bobby Roode was throwing everything he could at James Storm, and nothing was working. He was trying to just do everything, and he could not beat this guy. No matter what he did, it was not working. Referee Brian Hebner got bumped out to the floor, and Rude was sitting outside. And he looks over, and on top of the ring steps is the beer bottle that James Storm had brought with him to the ring. Because, you know, when James Storm made his entrance, he had the beer bottle, he set it right there on the ring steps. So now we have a shot of Bobby Roode staring at this beer bottle. And kudos to Impact. This was some of the best camera work that you'll ever see. They had a cameraman positioned on either side of him. And we had these great shots of Roode. You could just see. Like, you could see the look on his face, the gears going in his brain. Should I or shouldn't I? He sees the referee is down. He realizes he can't beat this guy otherwise. And it's like the switch gets flipped. It's like the bulb. The light bulb goes off in his head. He grabs the beer bottle. And when James Storm reaches through the ropes to try to bring him back inside, wham! He smashes the beer bottle over his head. The bottle shatters. And Storm is knocked out. Roode covers him. Waves the referee back inside. Come on, come on, let's go. And Bobby Roode wins the world title. And here's the other part about that that was so great. You talk about coming full circle. James Storm turned on Chris Harris. America's Most Wanted. Remember that? He turned on Chris Harris the exact same way in 2006. Storm smashed a beer bottle across Harris's, I think it was his face. And he turned heel. And here, Roode did the same thing to him. Fantastic. 8 years ago this week, on October 31st, 2012, Roman Reigns made his debut as Roman Reigns on NXT television against CJ Parker. He had been wrestling at FCW before that. He was going by the name Leaki. This was the Roman Reigns debut on NXT. And it was against CJ Parker. Now Parker wrestles as Juice Robinson in New Japan. And Reigns is the tribal chief, doing the best work of his career. It's crazy to think that this was his NXT debut, and it wasn't even 3 weeks later that he debuted at Survivor Series as a member of the Shield. You talk about being fast-tracked to the main roster. It's a pretty quick turnaround. 2 years ago this week, on October 28th, 2018, WWE held its first and to date its only all-women's pay-per-view called Evolution. From the Nassau Coliseum in Long Island, New York. One of the best WWE pay-per-views of 2018. Alexa Bliss against Trish Stratus was the very first match that was announced. And Lita was to have wrestled Mickie James. It ended up being changed to a tag team match with Trish and Lita taking on Alexa and Mickie. And then Mickie and Alicia Fox. Because Alexa was going to be in their corner. She was dealing with a concussion that she had sustained after a match that she had with Ronda Rousey. So Alexa did not get to wrestle on the show. Tony Storm pinned Io Shirai in a, I think it was the finals of the Mae Young Classic. Shayna Baszler regained the NXT women's title in a match against Kairi Sane. Becky Lynch retained her SmackDown women's title over Charlotte Flair in a last woman standing match. The best thing on the show. And Ronda Rousey retained her Raw women's title over Nikki Bella. This show does not happen without Ronda Rousey being in the main event. I know a lot of people think that it was done as a make good to the women who were not allowed to be on the show in Saudi Arabia. Because it was a Saudi Arabia show that month. And that may have played a role, but I believe that having Ronda Rousey on the card had more to do than anything else with them being willing to finally try an all-women's pay-per-view. And quality-wise, it paid off because it was a hell of a show. And they have not done another one since. And finally, 1 year ago this week, on Halloween 2019, WWE held its Crown Jewel event in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, or more accurately, you guys know, Sweet Saudi Money 4, The Search for More. More Money, that is. A show that saw Brock Lesnar tap out Cain Velasquez with a Kimura lock in 2 minutes. It remains the only WWE match that Cain has ever had. And in April of this year, he was part of the company's COVID cut, so he is no longer under contract to WWE. So Brock Lesnar got his win back, right? Cain Velasquez beat him in the UFC, and Brock beat him in WWE. I know it's hardly the same thing, but he got his win back. Hogan would be proud. The Good Brothers, Carl Anderson, who's having a very bad week. If you follow his wife's Instagram, I won't get into it, but he's not having the best week as Carl Anderson. But he and Luke Gallows, they won a tag team turmoil match, World Cup match, in fact, to be crowned the greatest tag team in the world. This after signing a new 5-year deal with WWE. And then a few months later, what happened? WWE released them. So much for job security. It doesn't matter. You could sign a 50-year deal. You could sign as long of a contract as you want to. It don't matter. The only ones who have protection are the company. The company can let you go anytime you want. Anytime they want to let you go, you're gone. Unfortunately, the talent does not have the same authority. They don't have the same power. So, how about that, WWE? I mean, that tells you right there what they think of tag team wrestling, that they would let go of the greatest tag team in the world. Tyson Fury beat Braun Strowman by countout. Dreadful. Dreadful stuff. Natalya beat Lacey Evans in the first ever women's wrestling match in Saudi Arabia. Team Hogan beat Team Flair because even with surrogates involved, Hulk Hogan can never, ever put over Ric Flair. I think it's been in all of his contracts for the last 30 or 40 years that he cannot do a job to Ric Flair, at least not fairly. In fact, Flair even did jobs for Hogan in matches that he wasn't even involved in. Talking about that strap match between Hogan and Vader in WCW that ended with Hogan dragging Ric Flair to all four corners. And The Fiend, Bray Wyatt, beat Seth Rollins in a Falls Count Anywhere match to win the Universal title. You know, instead of just having him win it like they should have at Hell in a Cell a few weeks earlier, they waited and they did it in Saudi Arabia. But the real drama came after the show was over, when the majority of the talent roster was left stranded on the runway in Riyadh. Vince McMahon made sure that he got the hell out of there first, as did some of the top names. But listening to Luke Gallows tell his version of what happened gave us the great line about them not knowing what was going on. They could see that there were people arguing. Some of the WWE people were kind of having these tense conversations on the runway with these Saudi officials, but nobody was telling the talent what was going on. Nobody knew what was going on. And, you know, when he talked about this in his shoot interview, he gave the classic line of thinking, they're going to kill all the mid-carders. They left the mid-card here to die. This came after reports of Vince McMahon having a big blow-up with Saudi officials at the show about not being paid the money they were owed and ordering that the local feed for the show be cut. Now, they deny that any such thing occurred, but something definitely happened and the local feed didn't start until, I think, an hour or two into the show. So something happened. I don't know that we'll ever get the full, clear story, but something weird definitely happened. This led to WWE scrambling to rebook the SmackDown show in Buffalo because these geniuses decided, hey, we're going to go right from Riyadh to Buffalo. What could possibly go wrong? Well, they had a Fox show in Buffalo the next night that they had to rebook, but what ended up happening was it gave us one of the best WWE television shows all year. The NXT invasion of the main roster. Adam Cole against Daniel Bryan in the main event. But that was the kickoff to the three-way brand feud that was heading into Survivor Series. And that is this week in wrestling history. Mailbag time. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I want you to mark this date down on your calendar as well. Thursday, November 12th. Thursday, November 12th. The time is to be determined. I'm thinking 8 p.m., maybe 8 p.m. or 9 p.m. that night, Eastern. I'm going to be going live on YouTube. It is the Sound Off Inbox Anniversary Edition. We're celebrating 13 years of the Sound Off next week, and we're having the first inbox in almost a year. I'm going to be answering your questions, 13 questions for 13 years plus super chats. We're going to take a whole bunch of questions that night. If you want to email me, you can email me for the show, as always, but I'll be pulling questions together this week. So this would be a great time to get those questions in and then join me live on YouTube on November 12th. That's not this Thursday. It's the following Thursday. Hope to see you all there. Dallas from Minnesota has two questions. If you could change the members of the NWO and limit it to 10, who would they be and how would you end the NWO in WCW? Your first mistake was having 10 members of the NWO. The NWO did not need 10 members. Of course, in the end, the NWO had about 30 members. But the NWO did not need 10 members. You have the original trio, Hogan, Hall, Nash. They recruit a younger guy. Obviously, Waltman was going to be part of the group, but maybe it's Waltman, maybe it's somebody else who could have been an even bigger star, right? But it's like a younger guy from the WCW roster. And then maybe the Giant, right? He could still join. He could be the muscle of the group. Him and Nash could be the muscle of the group. But that's it. That's really all the NWO needed. You probably would have the Bischoff affiliation, but he's not a wrestler. That's it. You really did not need more than that. Now, as far as how I would have ended the NWO, Starrcade 97 with Sting beating Hogan clean. That would have been the beginning of the end. I shouldn't say the end. That would have been the beginning of the end of the New World Order. I don't know what the hell they did. Whatever they did that night was exactly the opposite of what they should have done. Yes, Sting did win in the end, but I don't think they could have botched it more badly if they tried. And think about how long they built that up for. That should have been a gimme. That should have been a slam dunk that night. You go in there, Sting beats Hogan clean. No false finish where Hogan basically pinned him clean. Bret Hart does not have to run in and punch the referee who did nothing wrong, which just made Bret look like a dick. I mean, everything that could have gone wrong did go wrong. And depending on who you believe and what happened and why it happened, there's a lot of stories about that match. But it's very simple. Hogan submits to the Scorpion Deathlock right in the middle of the ring. And on Nitro, the next night, Hogan pays respect to Sting as being the better man. And that's when Hall and Nash and the rest of the NWO come out. Can't believe what they're hearing. And they kick Hogan out of the group. They kick him out of the NWO for being soft. I mean, they really lay a beating on him. They bloody him up. Eventually, Sting makes the save. Hogan, though, is hurt. He disappears from TV for about a month or so. At the next pay-per-view, Sting could defend his title, you know, against one of the other members, maybe the Giant. And he wins. NWO gangs up on Sting after. The numbers are too great. And that's when Hogan returns to rescue Sting. Trying to return the favor, get revenge on the NWO. Hulk Hogan is back. He's been gone for 4 weeks, 5 weeks. Here comes Hogan. And that then leads to a tag team match on pay-per-view with Hogan and Sting as tag team partners against Hall and Nash. You get another pay-per-view main event out of it. Let's say it's Super Brawl. I think people would have been willing to pay to see Hogan and Sting as a team trying to take out the remaining members of the NWO with the stipulation that if they win, if Hogan and Sting win, the NWO would have to completely disband. And that's when they pull a horseman on Sting. Hogan turns on him during the match. It was all a setup. It was all a ruse. And he helps Hall and Nash win. They set a trap. Sting walked right into it, which Sting was known to do. He did it at least once before with Ric Flair and the Horsemen in the past. So history repeats itself yet again. I know it's a little bit of dumb baby face syndrome with Sting, but they set the trap. Sting walks right into it. Now you get a second Hogan versus Sting match that you can promote on pay-per-view for the world title. Let's say Spring Stampede, right? Was it Spring Stampede or Uncensored? I think it might have been Uncensored, whatever the March pay-per-view was. I feel like it was Uncensored. But Hogan wins the belt back. And yes, it is a short reign for Sting, but Goldberg, by this point, is getting hot, right? He's undefeated. Every week that goes by, he's racking up wins. The fans are getting louder and louder and louder, and they're into his matches. You could see at that point, by March, April, you could see that Goldberg is on a hot streak, and we got to really just make sure that we, you know, nurture this guy, don't fuck this up, keep this momentum going. It's already obvious. I mean, the writing is on the wall where things are going with Goldberg. You start setting him up early to be the one to take that title off of Hogan. Sting is always going to be in the mix. Sting is always going to be there. You promoted Sting. I mean, that was the big thing for a year and a half until Sting finally got the win. And he had a few months with the championship, but Hogan gets the belt back. Hogan has to get the belt back to get it off him onto Goldberg a few months later. And I would have stuck with that. I would have stuck with that plan. But I think you hitch your wagon to Goldberg at that point and you run with it. And after Goldberg wins the title that summer, and I probably would not have done that on TV, I would have, you know what, I mean, I don't know why they couldn't have just set up the pay-per-view that month from the Georgia Dome instead of doing it on Nitro. That should have been a pay-per-view. With Goldberg winning the title from Hogan in the main event. After Goldberg wins the title, the NWO can try, they could fail to get the belt back. That's where the fracture begins. And the cracks start to show, and they sort of start eating each other from within until the split finally happens and they all just go off on their separate ways. So by that point, you will have gotten 2 full years, a little over 2 full years, of the NWO, which was more than enough. And that's the way I would have handled it. Now, Dallas's other question says, during Ric Flair's 1991 to 93 run in the WWF, let's say he got to form his own Four Horsemen group, who from the WWF roster at the time do you think could have worked in a hypothetical WWF incarnation of the Four Horsemen? Well, it's very simple. Mr. Perfect. If Perfect is still hurt, if Perfect has the back injury, Mr. Perfect is the manager. Razor Ramon. And Shawn Michaels, and I know Razor's gimmick didn't really fit, but I look at that roster back then, there really aren't that many great options. I mean, I guess Rick Martel could have worked, maybe, but I think Razor. I mean, Razor, you know, he's one of those guys, you kind of underestimate how physically big and imposing he really was. And, you know, in WWE, he got over with the audience. I would put him on that list of guys who could have and maybe should have at some point, were it not for his issues, been a world champion. Kind of surprised that he never got even just one short run with the world title. But he could have been groomed to be that kind of guy. I think he could have worked in the Horsemen. Shawn Michaels is a gimme. I mean, Shawn Michaels had just gone solo in early 92. Brash, cocky, arrogant. I could see Shawn with Sherry at his side. Sherry could be the dame of the group. Shawn showing up wearing the suits, you know, almost like being taken under Ric Flair's wing. So that's kind of what I would see the Horsemen of being. Perfect is the manager. You got Razor, you got Shawn, maybe with Sherry at his side. Flair, obviously, and there you go. I mean, there's your WWE version of the Horsemen. Ideally, though, if Perfect didn't have the back injury, then he would be in there as a wrestler with Flair and Michaels. And Bobby Heenan would be in the J.J. Dillon role. Michael from Liverpool, England. One potential dream match that we have yet to see but fans barely seem to bring up is Triple H against AJ Styles. With AJ now being back on Raw, he could certainly open up the door for a feud between the two heading into next year's WrestleMania. Of course, it would depend on Triple H wanting to invest time in training for an in-ring return. What are your thoughts on a potential match? I'm not sure what AJ being on Raw has to do with there suddenly being a better shot at doing a Triple H match. I mean, is Triple H part of the Raw roster? And I'm not aware. I don't quite get that part, but I have no interest in seeing it. I really don't. I really don't have any interest in seeing it. Triple H's last few matches have been plodding. They have been boring. They have not been good. AJ, is probably the best person for him to work with at this point. But I really don't have an interest in seeing any more Triple H matches at WrestleMania. I guess the Batista match wasn't horrible, but I didn't think it was great. It was great that Dave got the closure he wanted. I know he's wanted that match for a long time. Honestly, the last great Triple H match I could think of that I really enjoyed and was entertained by was the mixed tag. It was Kurt Angle and Ronda Rousey against Triple H and Stephanie. They had the best match at WrestleMania 34. I'm not going to lie. That was the best match on that show. Go back even earlier than that. I mean, it's probably Triple H and Daniel Bryan at WrestleMania 30. I mean, I can count on one hand the number of what I think are great Triple H matches that I really enjoyed in the last 5 or 6 years and still have fingers left over. So I just don't have any interest in seeing it. And Neil from North Carolina, with Halloween, it got me thinking about my favorite Halloween movie, Scream, starring Neve Campbell. I had a major league crush on her back in the 90s when I was a kid. What celebrities did you have a crush on in the 90s? I had to think about this for a little bit, and I just scribbled down a few names. First of all, my first crush, and I'm sure a lot of you were the same way, longtime wrestling fans, was Miss Elizabeth. Miss Elizabeth was my crush when I was a kid. But, you know, some of the other names, I mean, Cindy Crawford, Kathy Ireland, Tiffany Amber Thiessen, Kelly Kapowski, right, from Saved by the Bell, and Lark Voorhees, Lisa Turtle, who I don't believe is in this Saved by the Bell reboot that is coming out very soon on Peacock. Jenny McCarthy, used to watch her all the time on Singled Out. And Jennifer Love Hewitt. All right, I know what you did last summer. I still know what you did last summer. Actually, she did a movie that does not get any attention because it was not a big movie, but it was her and Will Friedle, who was the star. And he played the older brother, Corey's older brother, on Boy Meets World. And it was a movie, Trojan War. There it is. And you can probably derive from the name what it's about. It's a comedy, but it was called Trojan War. I love that movie. And she had a role in that movie. I think I probably saw most of the shit that she was in back in the day. So yeah, we all have our crushes when we were kids and teenagers, right, to look back on. And then, of course, there's always Kona Crush. Can't forget about Kona Crush. All right, if you have questions, you know what to do. You know where to reach me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Again, book that date. Mark it down. Thursday, November 12th. I'll let you guys know what time. I'll be live on YouTube. We're going to do a big Sound Off Inbox Anniversary Edition celebrating 13 years of the Sound Off. I might even break out some of the bubbly. And somebody for my birthday actually got me a gift card for 2 bottles of the Chris Jericho Little Bit of the Bubbly, which I only first received a couple of days ago. So we might break that open on the anniversary stream. I'm going to be back with you for episode 677 of the Sound Off. That's coming up next Sunday. I'm going to be doing a separate stream on Saturday night. Join me live on YouTube. I'm going to be reviewing the AEW Full Gear pay-per-view. But before that, I'll be live on YouTube this Wednesday for my weekly AEW Dynamite stream. We always have fun doing those streams. So I hope you'll join me. A lot of content coming up. Going to blow it up here in November. Thank you for all your support. As always, don't forget the 13-year anniversary shirt is still available on ProWrestlingTees.com/SolomonsterSoundsOff. I'm out of here. I will see you guys later this week and again next weekend. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
It was time for the big steak dinner between Chris Jericho and MJF. And MJF orders himself a 20-ounce porterhouse. Well done. Chris Jericho says, I'll have my steak medium well. MJF changes his to medium. Let me interject here. Everybody knows that the correct way to eat your steak, medium well. And if you want to have ketchup with your steak, there's nothing wrong with that either. A nice medium well steak with some ketchup. There you go.
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solo Monster Sounds Off.